Good afternoon, everybody. I will bring to order the Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Conference Committee. Welcome, one and all. And we have a very unique conference committee this biennium. So Chair Wolgamont and I are sharing the gavel. So we will go House, the Senate, back to House. It'll be a different chair. So we'll be going back and forth that way. So thank you, everyone, for being in the room. We have quite a few testifiers. So, of course, the first thing we'll do is we'll go through the nonpartisan walkthrough. After that, we'll go through testimony, and I ask you to keep it to no more than 3 minutes. 2 minutes would be preferred. We do have a lot of people, and I know if you haven't previously signed up, I will always ask the public if there are additional testifiers. So do not worry if you have not signed up in advance. Thank you all for showing up. And, of course, to my left, I have Senator Fattah. So he will be chairing the next committee after this. The other thing I would say is that we are going to be in public as much as humanly possible. We will be doing trading offers publicly, so you, the public, will know exactly what we're doing and what we're agreeing to and what we are not, and you can see the progress live and up close and personal. And that was the preference of the House, and I thank the Senate for agreeing with that position. So we already won for transparency. One for transparency. Here we go. Okay, so with that, we will just dive right in, and we're going to do the first thing we're going to do is a walkthrough of the spreadsheet, and I will turn to our House Nonpartisan Fiscal, Mr. Savory, to do the walkthrough.
Thank you, Chair and members, for the tape. Ken Savory, Nonpartisan House Fiscal Analysis. In your packet is a spreadsheet dated on 5-6-2025 at 10:39 a.m. in the lower right-hand corner. On the spreadsheet are change items for the various agencies within the committee's jurisdiction, and we'll go through kind of line by line and on each change item between House and Senate positions. The House columns are located on the leftmost side, so that's columns C through I, and then the Senate columns are located on the more the right-hand side, which is J through P. We'll go through line one, which is just the overall review of the both positions' targets. You'll see on line one is a general fund net total, and the general fund net total for the House in both bienniums was zero change from base, or a zero target. And for the Senate, in columns M and P, you'll see it was $100 million and $25 million, respectively. That also takes into account any changes made in FY 2025. So in the first biennium, it's a combination of FY 2025, 26 and 27, that gets you to the net number for the targets. We'll go down to line four, which is the first change item. It's the state grant program. And the House has a biennial change of $33,448,000 and $35,282,000 in the tails. And the Senate has a change from base of $104,520,000 and a change of $29,354,000 in the tails. You'll notice in the language that the House establishes a four-year tuition and fee maximum and limits tuition increases to 1%. And you'll see the Senate has extended availability in the language all the way till June 30th, 2029 for the appropriation. The next change is on line five, which is child care grants. At the Senate-only position of a $2 million increase in FY 26-27 and the identical amount in 28 and 29. Line six is a change to the state work study, and the House has a change of a reduction of $5.5 million in FY 26-27 and $5.5 million in the tails, and the Senate has a reduction of $1.3 million in 26-27 and then $1.3 million in 28-29. Line seven is the Tribal College Supplemental Grant Assistance Program. It's a House-only item of a $500,000 per year increase or $1 million biennial increase in 26 and 27, and then the same amount in FY 28-29. And the House and Senate there have slightly different rider language related to the amount of the grants to the tribal colleges is the one kind of language difference for that one. And then on line eight, you'll see the Get Ready program. That's another House-only change of a reduction of $60,000 in FY 26-27, and then the same identical amount in the tails. Line 29 is a Senate-only item related to MINEP, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. It's a $90,000 reduction in FY 26-27 and the same reduction in the tails, so the appropriation would have no base in the bill. Line 10 is a Senate-only item as well related to the United Family Medicine Residency Program. It's a reduction of just over $1 million in FY 2026-27 and the same amount in the tails. Line 11 is another Senate-only item. It's an increase to the Minitex program. It's $1 million in the first biennium and $1 million in the second biennium. Line 12 is another Senate-only item related to the Hennepin Healthcare Graduate Family Medicine Medical Education Program. It's a reduction of $1,290,000 and the same amount in the tails. Line 13 is a House-only item. It's the Summer Academic Enrichment Program. It's a reduction of $500,000 in each biennium. Line 14 is related to the Emergency Assistance to Postsecondary Students, the EAPS grants. For the House, it reduces the entire program, all $7,158,000. And then for the Senate, it reduces a slightly different amount of $6,058,000 in both the upcoming biennium and the tails. To note there that the House and Senate both directly appropriate the portions to Minnesota State and the U of M, and but the Senate language keeps the nonprofit or nonprofit portion within OHE. Line 15 is a Senate-only item related to the underrepresented student teacher grants. It's a reduction of $1 million in each biennium. Line 16 is a item related to the student loan debt counseling grants. It's a reduction of $400,000 in FY 2026-27, the same amount in FY 2028-29. And the Senate proposal there is a $100,000 increase above base for each biennium. Line 17 is related to the Hunger Free Campus grants. This is a Senate-only change. It's a reduction of $1.6 million in both biennium. The difference here in the language is the House keeps the entire appropriation within OHE, and the Senate language reduces the appropriation to OHE and it directly appropriates that amount to the U of M and Mid-State. But the portion remaining within the OHE would be for nonprofit or tribal institutions. Line 18 is the Fostering Independence Higher Education Grants, or FIG, the Senate-only item of an $8 million increase between both biennium's. Line 19 is the concurrent enrollment grants. House and Senate both have changes of $680,000 between both two-year periods. Line 20 is the Student Parent Support Initiative. This is a House-only change of a reduction of $4 million in the upcoming biennium and a reduction of $6 million in FY 2028-29. Line 21 is the Direct Admissions Minnesota program. It's a Senate-only item of a $500,000 increase in the first biennium and a $500,000 increase in the tails. Line 22 is related to the Paramedic Scholarships Program. It's a Senate-only item of $2 million in FY 2026-27 and $2 million in the tails. Line 23 is related to the Hennepin County Medical Center Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. It's a Senate-only reduction of $540,000 in the next biennium and $540,000 in the tails. Line 24 is for agency administration. The House change is $490,000 in 26 and 27 and then $656,000 in 28-29. The Senate position is slightly higher and also incorporates a change from line 25. But the change, total change would be $540,000 in FY 2026-27 and then $706,000 in 28-29. Line 25 is a change from the Senate-only change, and it's related to the campus sexual assault reporting. And what it does, it deletes the rider of $25,000 and incorporates that into the administrative line item that we talked about just a moment ago. And then the last change item for the Office of Higher Ed is a House-only item related to an FY25 cancellation of $15,262,000 that the House cancels and then carries forward into the next fiscal year.
Thank you. We're going to take a little pause right here so everyone understands what we just walked through. Do members have any questions at this point? Do you want to know what the Senate was up to? I do. So if you don't have that question, I do. Okay, Chair Wolgamott. So I'm going to ask Chair Fate, in line 11, you increased $1 million to Mintex, and I'm wondering if we didn't have that change. I'm just wondering what was the need there.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was an increase for the operating costs by capacity to Senator Putnam as well.
Senator Putnam.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. For clarity's sake, is there uncertainty about the nature of Mintex and what it does, or the rationale for the financial decision that Senator Fateh made?
Thank you for that question, Senator Putnam. My question is, we didn't hear in the House side that there was a need for additional funding, and so I'm just wondering if you heard differently or if you knew something that we didn't know. So I'm just trying to be informed. Senator Putnam.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Madam Chair. There is a deep concern about access to information throughout the state. Mintex obviously treats like one library becomes the state's library, interlibrary loan, all these other kind of wonderful things. And some of the challenges that libraries in general are facing, in addition to academic libraries, I think that's part of the rationale for the need and the increase in funding.
Thank you, Senator Putnam. Okay, any other questions from members? Do you have any questions, Senate, for what we did differently than you did? Because there's obviously the vast majority of this section, there are differences between House and Senate. I see the only thing that we agreed on was concurrent enrollment grants is the only thing that we cut that was the same. Everything else is very different. Senator Fateh.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You can get us a $100 million budget target. That would help.
So we would love to be able to do that, but we took a different approach. So I'm going to start with Chair Robbins, Representative Robbins, and then I'll go to Chair Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question for the Senate is, it looks like you cut the different residency programs, and we didn't increase them, but we held them harmless. So I wondered if you could just speak to why those were cut.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So as a committee, both sides, there was an agreement and discussion around eliminating the nonprofit appropriations. And so that was one of the ones that we did under that.
Okay. Chair Robbins, anything else? Chair Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And just want to say I appreciate the open conversation and having this exchange of information be made public. I was curious about line 17 on the Hunger Free Campus grants. That's something that Senator Putnam and I have worked together on over all the years, and just was curious to hear the Senate position on line 17, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Putnam.
Certainly, thank you for the question. Senator, I don't know if that's a promotion or a demotion. I'm not sure which one it is. But then you'd have my job, actually, since we're neighbors. So I think that's just my way of getting out of here. I don't know. I will say, for clarity's sake, we did not cut that appropriation at all whatsoever. We just changed the way that it's sent out. It was purely a policy change. The money is still the same. It just makes it easier for the money to get to the programs that need it. That was the change that we made.
Thank you, Senator Putnam. That is what I was going to say as well, but I figured you would know the answer to that. Chair Wolgamott, do you have anything else? So we also did that on
nothing
House
further
side
for now.
With EAPS, so the Emergency Assistant Grants. We did a direct appropriation to the institutions, and so the only thing different was the nonprofits. So we didn't have the nonprofits. They have the nonprofits. Any other questions about changes? Yes, Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for the House position as well. On line 20, the Student Parent Support Initiative, one of the ideas that animated the Senate position was attention to student basic needs. So, and I know that's something that you all believe in too. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about why that budgetary decision was made to zero out student parent support in the House position.
Yeah, I'll start, and then I'm actually going to turn to Chair Wolgamott, because we have a very unique position in the House, and we have to both agree to something for it to happen. So I kind of wish the Senate was the same way, don't you, Senator Duckworth? So we had the GOP position. We had a multitude of different cuts because we had zero target, and so the only way to make the state grant program whole, at least as much as we could, besides doing levers, was to do cuts and reappropriation. And so we had multiple things that we had suggested that we could cut. It was one of the things that the House Democrats agreed to do. And I'll say the reason why we looked at it is because it is a program that just was set up and just started less than 2 years ago. And so it's not really fully up and operational. It's money that goes directly to the institutions as opposed to directly to the students. And so we saw that distinction. As much as we would have liked to keep it, it was something that we could agree on to scale back and then phase out. We really tried to focus on things that are money directly to students, like the state grant, work study. Although we did trim work study because it was not being utilized and it was a place that was honestly just being canceled back to the general fund anyway. But so that's sort of the GOP position, but I'll turn it to Chair Wolgamont to see if he has additional comments.
Well, thank you. I think that was a really well put explanation, Madam Chair. And I'd also add, Senator Putnam, we came into our negotiations with a zero target, but it also felt like we had a negative $239 million target because we both shared the priority of trying to fix the state grant program. And so we had to make some tough choices. And especially to wrap the bill, we needed to make some cuts with zero targets so that we could fund the state grant program and try to fix that. So spot on with everything that Chair Rarick said. But also, yeah, I think it was the unique nature of getting a zero target, having the $239 million deficit in the state grant program, and just trying to figure out, we've got a slate of what I saw were bad choices, and we did our very best to work together and support students the most. And, it's unfortunate that the state grant program had such a deficit, but we really tried our best to work together in good faith and make difficult decisions to best support students.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. Yeah, we sure did. We even left the child care grants whole. We didn't know about the FIG program problem before we went to break, and so we really heard it when we got back from break. But we did what we could that is direct appropriations and direct to students. And so anything that was even a little bit ancillary, we did look at it with the grants to the hospitals for the residency programs, you took a really hard look at that. We did too, but we left them as they were. It wasn't something that we could fully agree to across both caucuses. So any other questions at this point of these? Most of the changes are here. There's less changes, although I do believe the Senate did quite a bit of change in the U of M appropriation, so we'll spend some time there as well. Any other questions from members about this part of the spreadsheet? Wonderful. Okay, moving on. Is it back to Mr. Savory then? Okay, wonderful. Thank you for your hard work, Mr. Savory, all session long. To you.
And Madam Chair and members, we'll begin again on line 28, which is the various transfers that occur within OHE. The first one is on line 29. It's related to the spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury research grants. It's a House-only position of a reduction of $5 million in the first biennium and $5 million in the second biennium. Moving down to line 30 is a reduction to the dual training grants, specifically the legal cannabis employers portion. The House position is a $500,000 reduction in the first biennium and a $500,000 in the second biennium. The Senate has a cancellation in FY25 of $500,000 and then a reduction of $1 million each fiscal year in 26 to 27, and then the same reduction of $1 million each fiscal year in 28 and 29 for $2 million total. Line 31 is the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program. It's a House-only item. It's a $400,000 reduction in 26 and 27 and a $400,000 reduction in FY28-29. Line 32 is the Rural Veterinarian Loan Repayment Program. The House position reduces the transfer by $100,000 in 26 and 27, and then $100,000 in FY28-29. The Senate position is slightly different, and it reduces $250,000 in each biennium. Line 33 is the Ag Educators Loan Repayment Program. The House reduces the transfer by $10,000 in FY26-27 and $10,000 in FY28-29. And the Senate reduces the transfer by $100,000 in 26 and 27 and $100,000 in FY28-29.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. We'll take a little pause there again real quickly. Mr. Savory, the dual training grants in line 30. Is the Senate position that that is the total appropriation that would go for the cannabis employees? Mr. Savory?
Chair and members, the in 26 and 27, the original base for that cannabis piece is $1 million each year. So the Senate position would be to eliminate that. There was previously dollars that were transferred to the fund or transferred to the account FY25, and the Senate reduces $500,000 of those dollars, cancels it, and brings it back to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Okay, so that is the difference there. And I'll just quickly note, too, on line 32, that the Rural Veterinary Loan Repayment Program, that was a position of the governor, as we know, to zero that out. And I would note that the Senate did a little larger trim than we did, but did not zero out. So thank you for that. And also on the next line down, the ag educators, the governor recommended a zeroing out of that. And I believe that is a zero out then. That's correct. Okay, so that is a zero out there. We just did a 10% trim, so 10,000 trim, and you did the zeroing out there. Okay. And we both eliminated the aviation degree loan repayment program. So that is the one thing that we actually did that was the same. Any other questions from other members about the other components? Okay, seeing none. Are you continuing, Mr. Savory? Okay, wonderful.
And then, Chair and members, that wraps up the Office of Higher Ed, and we'll go down starting on line 36, which is the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, MinState. The first change item is on line 37, and lines 37, 38, 39, and 40 are all related. The Senate on line 37 increases the unallocated amount of O&M by approximately $75,644,000, and the same amount in the tails. And that is from freeing up rider language related to student tuition relief, $75 million. Line 39, sexual assault reporting policies, $80,000. And line 40, menstrual product access of $564,000. So the sum of that is no longer a designated amount with an O&M and just simply floats to the unallocated amount in the available appropriation. And then line 41 is free course materials, Z degrees. It's $1 million increase for the appropriation in 26 and 27, and then $1 million in 28 and 29. That's a Senate only position. Line 42 is the Lake Superior College ERTC PFAS remediation. It's $1 million one-time appropriation only in FY26. And then on line 43 is the emergency assistance for post-secondary students, the EATS grants. This is the movement of the deletion of those dollars in the OHE portion and then moving them back down to the Minnesota State portion. So with that being said, line 26 and or FY26-27 for the House is $4.5 million and the same amount in the tails, and the same amount is also displayed in the Senate columns. And line 44 is a similar change related to the Hunger Free Campus grants. Again, this is moving in the Senate position from moving that from the OHE side of the ledger to the MinState side of the ledger. So $1.2 million in each biennium. And then line 45 is a Senate-only position. It's a cancellation in FY25. Members might recall in the 2024 session, the only House Higher Education, House Senate Education item to pass was the $500,000 appropriation to the Minnesota State Kids on Campus, and the Senate cancels that FY25 appropriation and carries it into the next biennium. And then, Chair and members, that wraps up the first page of the spreadsheet, and I would turn it over to my colleague, Megan Bursch, to cover the rest of it.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. So I have one question on this section, which is line 42. That is something that I'm aware of, but we didn't really have a discussion about in the House. And I'm wondering if anyone on the Senate side could let us know what that appropriation is for.
Yes, thank you so much. This was a bill brought from Senator Rarick, who's a co-author on this. I'm sorry. I apologize. I try to get a good one. I'm sorry.
It may help you. It may not.
It's for
people.
It's for PFAS remediation at Lake Superior, and we got the money from, I believe, the Kids on Campus Initiative, so we shifted that over from there.
Very good. And Senator or Chair Fattah, would you let us know just a little bit about the need there?
Sure, and I believe Mr. Oman is here, who can speak to the context of that as well. Mr. Bernie Oman. Or later in the public testimony, if that's better.
We can do it now, or we can do it later. So I'm fine if he wants to just come up real quickly now and explain what that is, just because we didn't have that as a House bill. Mr. Oman, you may come up now. If that's right with you and us, we'll just listen real quickly to what you have to say about, and I don't know if you heard what we were talking about, the line 42, Superior Lake College, PFAS remediation. Mr. Oman, to you.
Chair Rarick, Chair Fattah, and members, so early on in session, or beginning, we learned of a PFAS issue at Lake Superior. There's an emergency training center that's not at their campus, that is a ways away. And through some work with MPCA, we became a willing partner to try to clean up that site. So instead of just coming to the legislature with the problem, we also think we came with a solution in that last session. Our folks in student affairs did their due diligence as it relates to the Kids on Campus initiative, and we communicated that with many of you, and including Representative Coulter, who was the main author of that bill, and suggested that that be canceled and partially remediate the cost that Lake Superior has. They have multiple jurisdictions in the region that emergency management folks have trained at, firefighters and so on. And it's a really a delicate situation, because the river kind of goes right by, and they've had some contamination and then going into Lake Superior. So as you could imagine, the cost to the campus to be the willing partner has really added up. I think they're in the neighborhood of $1 million. So this is just an effort to give them some support at the campus. And those of you that have heard me testify before about campus bringing individual items to the legislature know that we push back, because we try to act as a system. And this is one where we have brought forward something where the campus isn't going backwards, because they will end up eating and blowing through this their reserves. So we appreciate the consideration, and we, because this is also an environmental issue, we were trying particularly with those committees to get some traction, and working with the Senate and a bipartisan coalition of the Duluth area legislators, they've been very supportive. So we're hoping to be able to continue this work. It's a vast training center, both with for credit, but also, as you could imagine, the local firefighters and so on enjoy that that facility as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oman. Any questions from House members or Senate? But we hadn't really talked about this much in the House. Okay, everyone's clear about what it does. Thank you, Mr. Oman. Appreciate your time. Okay, so then we will turn it over to Ms. Bush, and she can continue on with the University of Minnesota side of the spreadsheet.
Chair Rarick and members, my name is Megan Bursch, and I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst supporting the Senate Higher Education Committee. I'll be continuing the change item walkthrough at the top of page 2 of the spreadsheet, starting with the University of Minnesota on line 47. One thing I want to acknowledge up front is that in addition to the changes in the dollar amounts, the Senate bill also proposes a significant restructuring of the University of Minnesota appropriations section. At a high level, the new structure disaggregates existing riders into their component parts to reflect the breakdown that the university honors based on prior year agreements. And then it reorganizes those parts as special appropriations within subdivisions that are based on major subject areas. I'll leave it at that for now to maintain the focus on change items, but it's a difference to be aware of between the bills that will need to be reconciled at some point. But back to the numbers. The House bill increases total appropriations to the University of Minnesota from the base set by the February forecast by $3.78 million in fiscal years 25 through 27, and decreases total appropriations by $11,482,000 in fiscal years 28 and 29. The Senate bill decreases total appropriations to the university by $5,752,000 per biennium. On line 48, both the House and the Senate opted to consolidate certain riders into operations and maintenance. On lines 49 and 50, the Senate bill consolidates $1 million per biennium for University of Minnesota Morris tuition waivers for American Indian students, and $220,000 per biennium for menstrual products access that the House doesn't. And on line 51, the House bill consolidates $6.5 million per biennium for cannabis research that the Senate doesn't. On line 52, the House bill eliminates the $15,982,000 per biennium appropriation for the University of Minnesota Mayo Foundation partnership, while the Senate bill makes no changes. On line 53, the Senate bill eliminates the $1,408,000 per biennium system special appropriation for the Research and Innovation Office, while the House bill makes no changes. On line 54, the Senate bill eliminates the $58,000 per biennium system special appropriation for economic development research, with no changes in the House bill. On line 55, the Senate bill eliminates the $280,000 per biennium system special appropriation for the Bell Museum, while the House bill makes no changes. On line 56, the Senate bill eliminates the $184,000 per biennium system special appropriation for the Humphrey Forum, and the House bill makes no changes. On line 57, the Senate bill eliminates the $1,692,000 per biennium College of Science and Engineering appropriation for the Minnesota Geological Survey, and the House bill makes no changes. On line 58, the Senate bill eliminates the $588,000 per biennium College of Science and Engineering appropriation for the Talented Youth Mathematics Program, and the House bill makes no changes. On line 58, On line 59, the Senate bill eliminates the $6.5 million per biennium appropriation for cannabis research that the House consolidated into operations and maintenance back on line 51. On line 60, both the House and the Senate bills include a new $3 million per biennium appropriation for a partnership between the University of Minnesota Medical School and CentraCare for residency programs. On line 61, as Mr. Savory mentioned, both the House and the Senate bills make adjustments to how the existing base funding for the Emergency Assistance for Postsecondary Students grant program is appropriated, where it was all previously allocated through the Office of Higher Education. The House bill appropriates $1.5 million per biennium directly to the University of Minnesota, and the Senate bill appropriates $1,558,000 per biennium. On line 62, the Senate bill does something similar with hunger-free campus grants by appropriating $400,000 per biennium directly to the University of Minnesota, rather than allocating it through the Office of Higher Education the way it's been done in the past, and the House bill makes no changes. And on line 63, the House bill includes a new one-time $15,262,000 appropriation in fiscal year 2026 for ALS research grants, sourced from a cancellation of the same amount for the same general purpose in the Office of Higher Education back on line 26.
Thank you. We'll do a little pause here. Any questions from members on this section? There are quite a few differences between the House and Senate positions. We did not do very much change in the riders or the state specials for the University of Minnesota, other than we did a University of Minnesota Mayo Foundation partnership. We eliminated that. Any questions that we have from the House about the Senate position or vice versa? So I do have, do you have a question?
I do.
Oh, okay, so I'm gonna go to Representative Robbins and then I'll have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did wanna inquire why the Senate in line 57 did the cut on the Minnesota Geological Survey. I have heard from several constituents who are involved in well drilling and how important this is for making sure that there's clean water around the state and how to be effective in this area. So they had great concerns about this.
So Senator, Chair Fattay?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for the question. Yes, so for the Geological Survey, the Bell Museum, as well as the cannabis research, we focused on areas that were directly related to student support and student aid. And because of the situation we were in with the state grant program, that was our focus, as well as also, I'm sorry, the FIG program, the Fostering Independence Grants. So our goal was to make that whole and to help our students. But just coming into this for our position, and we can still have those conversations around how we can support.
Thank you. And my question would be maybe for your nonpartisan fiscal. So what I'm not sure of is that a full cancellation of the base appropriation for these things, because we don't have it quite broken out like that on the House side. Do you happen to know if that's the things that are listed under the University of Minnesota? Would that be canceling the base, or is it just trimming? Ms. Bursch.
Chair Rarick, there is kind of a mix. Most of these items are being eliminated in the Senate bill, but it depends on the specific rider that you have in mind.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could point to the ones that are complete eliminations. That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Let's see. On the Senate side, we have complete eliminations on line 53, the System Special Research and Innovation Office. Line 54, the System Special Economic Development Research. Line 55, the System Special Bell Museum. Line 56, the System Special Humphrey Forum. Line 57, College of Science and Engineering, Minnesota Geological Survey. Line 58, College of Science and Engineering, Talented Youth Mathematics Program. And line 59, Cannabis Research.
Thank you. So all of those are full eliminations of the base.
Correct.
Thank you. Any other questions from either side, House or Senate? Okay, please continue. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Chair Eric. So next we have the Mayo Clinic, starting on line 65. Both the House and the Senate bills eliminate the $1,330,000 per biennium appropriation for the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine on line 66. And the $2,268,000 per biennium appropriation for family medicine residency programs on line 67. So that leaves no direct appropriations to the Mayo Clinic in either bill.
Okay, are there any questions, House or Senate? That actually is one of the few things we agreed on. So any questions from either? No? Okay, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That covers the general fund change items. But there's also one non-general fund item. On line 72, both the House and Senate bills increase the statutory appropriation for the Office of Higher Education post-secondary institution licensing and registration from the Special Revenue Fund by an estimated $682,000 per biennium. And there's an equivalent revenue increase included in both bills on line 75. And those are the result of a proposed fee adjustment included in Article 2 that Mr. Watson and Mr. Hopkins will talk more about in their review of the policy items.
Thank you. Will we be doing the state grant parameters as well?
Yes.
Okay, before we go to that, any other questions about the fee increases and the increase in the state agency? So I think we've talked about that quite a bit on the House side. So, okay, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last section of the spreadsheet summarizes the fiscal impact of the state grant parameter changes proposed in Article 2 of each of the bills. For reference, in the 26-27 biennium, there is about a $239 million difference between the base level of state grant program appropriations and projected spending based on the parameters currently in statute. So that difference needs to be eliminated through some combination of appropriation increases, parameter changes, and rationing. The appropriation increases proposed in each bill were identified back on line 4. And the savings the parameter changes proposed in each bill are projected to achieve in the 26-27 biennium are identified on line 78 through 85. starting on line 78, the parameter changes proposed in the House bill are estimated to decrease state grant spending by $142,860,000 from the projection for the biennium. And the parameter changes proposed in the Senate bill are projected to decrease spending by $138,169,000. The impacts of each individual parameter change contributing to the overall savings are shown on lines 79 through 85. And again, Mr. Watson and Mr. Hopkins will review those changes in more detail in their review of the policy items. But that concludes our review of the spreadsheet and Article 1 of the bills, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Okay, one more pause. Any other questions before we move on to policy? Yes, Chair Fate.
Thank you. And this is for you, Madam Chair. I had a question about line 79, the limiting tuition increases to 1% per fiscal year. Not that I'm against it, just curious about the conversations that were had in committee and how you arrived at the 1%. I'm very interested in this.
Yes, thank you. So this came from brilliant staff. So we have some amazing both partisan and nonpartisan staff, and it was a suggestion kind of birthed out of a frustration of us not being able to close the gap. And so there was a desire, I think, throughout to try to be able to manage increases of tuition, and we can do that at the at Minn State. You know, we've had throughout the years, we've had tuition freezes. There was a hope that we could do something similar in the rest of our systems, and this cap was the attempt to try to do that. It's not a huge net in savings. It's about $17 million in savings, and it does cap it at 1%. So essentially what it means is if the University of Minnesota or the privates decide to raise their tuition more than 1%, then the state grant won't cover above that. And so that's where the savings comes from. So that's Chair Wolgamont, do you have more to say? Okay.
Well, I can, Madam Chair.
Okay, please.
Everything that Chair Rarick said is spot on, and I would just add additional context that having a tied House of Representatives puts us all in a difficult situation, and in negotiating our higher ed bill, we really just spent a lot of time in the room thinking of solutions, throwing, if I can use the expression, throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what stuck, and this stuck, and we brought this forward, and we had the main goal of doing everything we could to help fix the state grant problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where we landed. So I think one of the levers that is very different, this would be one, but another one that would be very different than the Senate position is that we decided to not do the negative 1,500 as you have a cap for the student aid index. We brought it just to zero. And of course, that was an $87.7 million savings to the state grant program. And so with a zero target, we had to make hard decisions. The other thing about that lever in particular, we found out as we were doing it, is that as I have the chair of the fraud committee next to me, we found that there was a potential, as you know as well, for fraud with that program, the way it was done. So it kind of killed two birds with one stone. It helped quite a bit in keeping students as much as possible. And as we know, that was a new change. It wasn't something that has been a longstanding way that things were done. And so we looked at that as well. And we, by making that choice, I think, Chair Wolgamont, that also saves the potential of fraud. Well, that's not potential. It's a reality of fraud in that particular area. So. Senator.
Yeah, I was going to ask, may I ask another question?
Oh, please. Yes, of course.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Rarick. I was wondering if the commissioner could come up to speak to that also, because we haven't heard that in our committee around some of the fraud stuff within the SAI, and I wanted to see if the commissioner can come speak directly to that.
I think that would be a great idea. If Commissioner Olson would join us, that would be fantastic. And I'll say, as he's coming up, I just want to thank you so much, Commissioner Olson, for being in our negotiations. And being that great offer of, you had just the great offer of information and data, and you were running things live when we were stuck. And these are one of the things that we talked about live in the room. And thank you to that. So I do you want to repeat your question unless he heard it? Commissioner Olson, do you want the question repeated? Senator Fate?
Yeah, just around some of the fraud discussions that were mentioned by both Representative Rarick and I'm sorry, Chair Rarick and Representative Wolgamott, Those are some of the things that we have not heard in committee, so I wanted to see if you had a chance to chime in on that.
Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Fattay, for the record, Dennis Olson, proud to serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And yeah, first, just want to, I guess, respond to Chair Rarick's, you know, comments around us being in the room. Appreciate the invitation for us to be available for any technical answers, you know, kind of provide numbers around some of the proposed parameter changes for the state grant. But do just want to clarify, you know, negotiations happen between chairs, and, you know, at some point we weren't available or in the room for those final discussions, which are reflected on a lot of the items in the spreadsheet. Just want to make sure that that was on the record. Secondly, in terms of the fraud discussion, that's something that did come up a few times in the House committee. However, you know, this is a component of financial aid, and, you know, there's really no evidence around the SAI piece of this formula that would suggest, you know, fraudulent activity. There may be, you know, comments that were shared, but from our perspective, you know, this should be treated as a component of financial aid, no different than a federal Pell Grant, no different than state grant, other gift aid, scholarships, institutional aid. And so it is, I will just say, a little just surprising to hear, you know, potential comments around fraud specific to the change in the SAI formula or change in Pell Grant to reflect SAI from AGI.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Fattay.
Thank you so much, Chair Rarick, and thank you so much for the comments, Commissioner. I remember in our committee we did hear issues around some of the ghost students around, which I think Senator Gustafson had a bill which we included in our policy bill, but that's separate and independent from this. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Chair Rarick and Chair Fattay, that is correct. Completely separate issues. Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions at this point? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn it over to, we're going to start policy discussion. Mr. Watson, it is you. You are up.
Thank you, Chair Rarick, members of the committee. I'm going to be walking through the side-by-side comparison that everyone has in their packets and referring to the summary of differences. There's a chart also in your packet. We'll start with Article 2, which is on R31. The first provision is a Senate-only provision, Section 1, which requires public and charter high schools to participate in the direct admissions program by the 2029-2030 school year. On that same page, both the House and the Senate have a change to the statement of mission for MinState, which allows the Minnesota State Universities to offer an applied doctoral degree in cybersecurity. These are identical. Turning to R32 of the side-by-side, the Senate has a provision requiring Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and requesting the University of Minnesota to maintain two doses of opiate antagonists in each campus residential building. The House doesn't have this here, but is carrying this provision in the currently in the omnibus health bill. On R33, the House adopts a section from OHE's agency bill making clarifying changes to the hunger-free campus statute. The Senate repeals the section but includes program parameters in the appropriation section, which you can see at R7 to R9 of the side-by-side. On R34, at the bottom, Section 4 of the Senate bill is a Senate-only change that defines retaliation, and the term is used in the following section relating to campus sexual misconduct policies. So that's a kind of a long section, and we'll go to R36, where both the House and the Senate make changes to the statute governing campus sexual misconduct grievance policies. They make different changes I won't go into at this time. And that goes all the way to R39. In R39, both the House and the Senate provide definitions for pregnancy and related conditions. The House refers to the federal rules, and the Senate provides the definition. The definitions are, in effect, identical. And then turning to R41. This is regards the treatment of appropriations. The Senate allows default retention by OHE of 5% of a competitive grant appropriation, unless the statute says otherwise. The House allows a 10% holdback. The House allows OHE to carry forward certain unspent operating appropriations into the next biennium, and the Senate does not. Also on R41, similar changes made by both the House and the Senate to consolidate OHE reporting requirements for specified programs, some differences in which programs are consolidated. These are mainly technical differences. On R42, there is a Senate-only provision, which proposes a new section of law requiring the Office of Higher Education to create standard terminology and standard templates for colleges and universities to use when sending financial aid offers to prospective and current students. There's a more detailed summary of everything that's in this bill and the bill summary to the Senate bill. So I will move forward to R48. This is a change to the state grant parameters that Ms. Birch discussed. The Senate increases so this is changing the definition for assigned family responsibility, or AFR. The Senate increases the AFR for dependent students to 100% of the parental contribution, and the House keeps it at 79%. The House sets all negative federal parental or student contributions as a zero AFR, and the Senate recognizes AFR for negative parental or student contributions down to a floor of negative $1,500. Also on R48, both the House and the Senate amend the eligibility requirements for institutions that receive state student financial aid. These sections are identical except for sort of technical differences in the language. And we can move to, that goes all the way to R50. So moving to R50. This is a Senate-only provision requiring post-secondary institutions that are eligible to receive state financial aid to post certain information about student outcomes on their website. And then also on R50 is another Senate-only change to the state grant parameters, reducing the allowance for living and miscellaneous expenses from 115% of federal poverty guidelines to 110% for the purpose of calculating cost of attendance. Going to R51 is another Senate-only change to parameters to the state grant program. This provides additional directions to OHE when it is required to reduce state grant awards due to an insufficient appropriation. This is the section that is referred to when people say rationing, for the most part. Then going down over to, also on R51, a Senate-only change relating to the state grants. Changing some of the options that OHE has when increasing state grant awards in the case of a surplus appropriation, and allows OHE to recognize a student parental contribution that is less than that negative $1,500 floor when calculating AFR, and it requires OHE to make that adjustment before increasing awards with the other lever, which is, that's the existing one, which is an increase to the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. Turning to R52, both the House and the Senate make a change to the state grant award parameters, lowering the maximum lifetime credit cap from 180 credits to 120. On R52, there's a Senate-only change to another part of the state grant parameter calculation, and it changes the deadline for applications for state grant awards for an academic term. The current language allows an applicant to apply up to the end of the fiscal year following the term that they're applying for is within. This would move it forward to 30 days after the start of each term that they're seeking an award for. On R52 also, both the House and the Senate make a change in the North Star Promise section, amending the definition of tuition and fees to ensure that only resident rates are paid under the program. And there's a similar change made in the next section on R53. Which is section 11 in the House and section 22 in the Senate. These are similar changes to the program requiring, so the House requires MinState and requests that the University of Minnesota ensure that all North Star Promise eligible students receive resident tuition rates. The Senate phrases this as a requirement on both systems.
Mr. Watson, can I ask you a question right there? So it's my understanding that the legislature can't require the University of Minnesota to do such a thing. Am I mistaken in that? Can we require them to do that, Mr. Watson?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about sort of the question of constitutional autonomy of the University of Minnesota.
Yes.
And I think that reasonable minds can differ on what the case law says on that point. I think there is Supreme Court cases that say that the legislature can attach reasonable conditions to an appropriation. And there's not like a three-part test or something, but, you know, there are different factors that a court would look at. So I think there is a reasonable argument that it would be constitutional for the legislature within the North Star appropriation to include a condition on resident tuition.
Thank you. So we'll let you finish, and then we will members will go to a discussion about particularly the sames and similars that you see, so the white portions. I'd like to have that conversation now so that tomorrow when we come back and we have the Senate with the gavel, we can actually make some progress and adopt some of those sames and similars, but I'd like to have that conversation around the table. So I probably should have interrupted you earlier, but as we look through this, have that in mind. So if there is a same or similar that you would oppose to, I particularly want to know that. I've already marked a few that I feel like are good things to adopt. So I will let you continue, Mr. Watson. Thank you for answering the question about the University of Minnesota autonomy.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Herrick. And the sames and similars are marked on the chart that everyone has. So if you are looking for those. Moving, I think we're on R53, and we have a same. Both House and Senate making a change in the North Star Promise program that clarifies that a student who has completed the degree requirements for their first baccalaureate degree is no longer eligible for the scholarship, even if a student has not yet graduated. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hopkins.
Thank you. So maybe what we'll do before we finish walking all the way through is we'll back up just a little bit so we don't get too far into this. And we'll go look at the, if you've got your colored sheet, we will look at the ones that are white. If you look to page 2, the first one, we can just have a conversation about these things. The same would be that we are permitting MinState to offer an applied doctorate degree in cybersecurity. So I think that from the House side, correct me if I'm wrong, we are very supportive of that measure, okay? And I'm assuming the Senate is as well. Anyone in disagreement? Seeing none, I think we'd like to adopt that. So when we come back tomorrow, Senator Fattah will mark that as a same and similar that we can adopt. Thank you. Okay, moving on to page 3, there are similar but technical differences on R41-42. And The notes that I have here is nonpartisan staff recommends the Senate language with directions and so on. So this is the consolidated competitive grant and student loan repayment programming reporting. And this is a OHE consolidating their reporting requirements. We did have quite a bit of conversation about OHE reporting requirements. Is there a question? Mr. Watson?
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Eric. I think that there was an earlier version of the chart which omitted that line, and some people have that. So if people I see people are looking for it in their chart, it's not in the one that is timestamp 32357. So I apologize.
Thank you for pointing that out. I didn't realize we had different sheets in front of us. So does everyone have that as a white portion and then that is a similar but different technical difference? Okay. So in my notes, it says that nonpartisan staff recommends the Senate language. Is that correct, Mr. Watson? I'm sorry, that's R4142 on page three.
Correct.
Okay. And it looks like our nonpartisan concur. Is there any conversation? Yes, Representative Holder.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just Chair Wolgamon, I were just talking, and I think I just want to clarify what we're discussing here right now. We're not actually taking action on any of these. The discussion here is just to say we agree these are the sames and similars that we'll come back tomorrow to adopt. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. I thought since we're walking it through, we could have a conversation. If you have questions around it, is it something that, you know, like cybersecurity, we know that we all agree to that. This is the consolidation of reporting from OHE. We talked about that at great length. If it's something that we know that we can agree to, we can note that we are not adopting it here. We're just having the conversation. So tomorrow goes a little faster.
I'm all for efficiency, Madam Chair. So thank you.
Yes. So does anyone at the table have any concerns about that section? Okay. All right. So no questions or concerns about it. We'll go back and look at it some more. I'm okay with that being adopted with the Senate language. I'll let my colleagues kind of think about it and talk about it some more tomorrow. The next similar but technical differences is R4850 at the bottom of the same page. And this one on my notes, it says nonpartisan staff recommends the House language. This is institutional eligibility additional requirements. Yes, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was curious about this additional requirement that the Senate put in here. And I guess looking at the language, it doesn't necessarily seem concerning or problematic to me. I'm curious if there's any particular reason why nonpartisan staff is recommending House language over the Senate language.
Yes, Mr. Hopkins has an answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Coulter, the House language is recommended for this provision specifically because it does not include that Senate-only provision. So by adopting the House-only language, the conference committee can leave discussion and consideration of that Senate-only provision for another day.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam. Okay, I think I maybe just misunderstood what the note was saying then there. The idea is to adopt, in essence, adopt the language that is the same, and then if we decide we still want that extra Senate piece, we can come back to it. Okay, thank you.
That is correct. Would anybody be opposed to tomorrow adopting this? Any concerns? Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to make this comments toward the end of this, but I'll just share them now for everyone's consideration. You know, depending upon all the different items that we kind of agree to that are same and similar, the only additional, concern or thought I would have is adopting any of them that impact money, to be honest with you, before we have an actual target that's agreed to. I don't want to necessarily put us in a position where we've accepted certain things that we now may want to reconsider accepting once a target has sort of been agreed upon, as we traditionally sometimes experience. So not to throw a wrench into the plan. I'm all about making as much progress as possible, but I don't necessarily, especially when it comes to changing some of the parameters to the state grant, want to get in a position where we've accepted some things and now seeing the kind of budget we have to work with, we then begin to rethink what it is we would accept. I guess we could always change our minds, but that's my feedback for what it's worth, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth. You have read my mind. That is, as we were going to be moving forward, that is exactly what I was going to say as well. There is one, really the only thing that there is the same is one of the levers, which is reducing the amount of credits that you can qualify for from 108 to 120, and we can have that full conversation if we want to adopt that or not. And I agree wholeheartedly that we don't want to, can't really adopt things that change the fiscal note until we know what our target is. So I appreciate that, and I apologize that I didn't say that up front, but we're really looking primarily at small technical policy changes, mostly housed within the OHE policy bill. But I will note that for some reason, the House and the Senate versions of the same OHE policy bill seem to be very different, and so I'm always curious as to how that happened, unless you went to the Judiciary Committee, and then I fully understand. So, okay. So with that, are there any questions, concerns, or comments about the R-48-50, which is the last item on page 3? Okay. Would the committee be amenable tomorrow to adopt this tomorrow, or would you like more consideration, more time to look at it? Chair Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think adopting these tomorrow works with our timeline in the House, DFL. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So are we amenable to adopting this provision tomorrow, or are there any concerns? I think you said you were okay with adopting. Any other concerns at this point? Okay. Seeing none, so we will put a pin. We'll agree to adopt that tomorrow with further discussion if we need be. Okay, so then continuing on, page 4. So that is exactly what Senator Duckworth and I just discussed, interestingly enough. And so this would lower the lifetime cap on the state grant from 180 credits to 120 credits. It is the one lever that we did agree upon from the House and the Senate language. Knowing that we have a $239 million gap that we have to fill, is there anyone here that would be opposed to adopting this tomorrow, or would you like to set it aside until after the target? Senator Fattay, Chair Fattay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My preference for the committee would be to set it aside just until we flesh out what the state grant parameters would look like. So I think there should be decided upon together.
Very good. Then we will set it aside. It only takes one. Okay. All right. So we will set that part aside until we actually have a target. Then a little bit further down on page 4, R-52, R-53. So this is some changes to the definitions in North Star Promise. Okay, any concerns? So this is actually same language, House and Senate. Any concerns about adopting this tomorrow under same? Senator Fattay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was told, I think, that the U might have some technical changes that they would like to make, but I'd like to hear from them first, probably, before we decide on that.
Should we do that now?
Is that okay?
Yes, let's do that now. Okay. Do we have somebody from the University of Minnesota that could speak to page 4, R-52, 53 of the same, and it's North Star Promise definitions? They're deciding. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. They're like, oh no, do we have to talk? Welcome to the conference committee and your willingness to come up and share your knowledge with us. Please state your name for the record. And are you aware of where I'm speaking from?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm the financial aid analyst for the Office of Undergraduate Education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities.
My name is Nate Peterson. I serve as the Executive Director of Student Finance for the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. We're just pulling up the document again on the larger screen rather than the phone, so just give us 1 second, please.
Could one of my partisan staff bring them that sheet? or page? It's we're working from this document.
Got it.
Page 4.
Madam Chair, we do have a question whether your comment regarding technical changes to be suggested by the University of Minnesota, was it in regards to the eligible resident change or if it's in the following section about requiring the board to adopt the resident tuition policy?
I'm going to turn back to the residents. I'm going to turn to Chair Fate to answer that. Chair Fate.
I believe the residence piece. Thank you.
Ms. Ferguson.
So we do have some concerns with the requirement for the board to adopt a resident tuition policy because of some, how do we say it? The University of Minnesota and the Office of Higher Education have different procedures for determining whether a student is eligible for in-state tuition. As opposed to Minnesota resident financial aid. And because those procedures differ, we do have some concerns if the board were required to adopt a policy without fully discussing how those two processes differ. There are some students who actually are granted in-state tuition residency at the University of Minnesota that do not qualify for state financial aid simply because of the differences in the two residency definitions. Would you like to add more, Nate Peterson?
Sure. I can, thank you. So I think from our perspective, we would rather have conversations about potentially capping the dollar amount at resident tuition rate as opposed to having us change what the definition of residency is for the university.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Chair Fate?
Yes. Do you have like a specific example of when the U might determine, make one determination for a student and he does not?
Ms. Ferguson, go ahead.
No, it's you.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair and Chair. So an example of that could be when the university is looking at a student who has been in the state for less than 12 months, perhaps to care for like a sick parent or something like that, and doesn't meet the 12-month residency. We can make that exception for a resident tuition rate based on the reason that they moved here not being specifically for school. That's one specific example. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. So a follow-up question. I appreciate that example. That kind of helped me. First question is, so based on what you just shared, there are some students who maybe wouldn't qualify as a Minnesota resident that are getting the Minnesota resident tuition rate at the U. Is that a correct statement?
Ms. Ferguson?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Yes, that is correct.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Senator Duckworth, of course.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the example that you shared. Could you give us an idea of how many students we're talking about that aren't actually, that don't meet the definition of a Minnesota resident, but are in fact getting a Minnesota resident tuition rate at the U?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator. I'll have to look that up specifically, and we can follow up with that number afterwards.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Absolutely, Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. Do you have a general sense what that number might be? A few hundred, a few thousand?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator. It's under a couple dozen.
Okay.
That's kind of the best way to put it, so it's not a ton of students.
Senator Duckworth?
Thank you. That's why I ask. I appreciate that. That's helpful context.
Very good. Representative Robbins?
Thank you. Following up on Senator Duckworth's question, I just wondered if a student doesn't meet the residency requirement, but they are given resident tuition, if you could just help me understand, do they then also qualify for North Star Promise, or is North Star Promise strictly based on residency?
Ms. Ferguson, or no? Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Tesfaye.
Thank you. The answer actually depends for North Star Promise on whether or not they meet the residency for the state of Minnesota's for OHE's definition of residency, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. So this is why we do this. Wonderful. So what I would ask is if you had language that would help us move this ball forward, that would be very helpful. And we will set this aside for right now. And we will not adopt this tomorrow, but we'll ask if there's some sort of happy medium language that we could work on, sort of get at the intent of what the language was supposed to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be happy to work with Gov Relations to make sure they get that to you.
Thank you, Ms. Ferguson. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, so we will set that one aside. Moving on, let's see. Mr. Watson, I'm not remembering where you stopped. What number were you at?
Thank you, Chair Eric. I had stopped at handing it over to Mr. Hopkins.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Watson. Mr. Hopkins, where are you going to begin? Because I have a few more of the sames that we could talk about if you haven't gotten to those yet.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the next item is a identical revision regarding the North Star Promise Program at R53 to R54, the conditions for eligibility.
Okay, so committee, this is another same language, House and Senate. Is there any known concerns about this language at this time? Anything that we can discuss? I'm just going to go to the any in the audience, because that might be helpful as well. Anyone in the public that has concerns about the North Star Promise conditions for eligibility, and it's listed as R5354. So I know that we've had Penn State come up, and we've had University of Minnesota come up. Okay. Not seeing any takers. Okay. Is this something that the committee would be comfortable adopting tomorrow? Any concerns? Seeing none. So we will put that in the bucket of we will adopt it tomorrow and have more discussion. Please continue, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, the next three sections are affecting the self-loan program. These are identical provisions at R54 to R55. They're from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill, and they are identical.
Okay, committee, this is, again, identical language about self-loan, and this comes from the OHE policy bill. Is there any concerns or comments about these two sections, R54 through 55? Seeing none, is this something that we would be comfortable adopting tomorrow, and if need be, having more conversation? So if anyone's listening and if they have concerns, they need to let us know tonight. Okay, seeing none, those are two sections that we will consider adopting tomorrow. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, at R55 is another provision affecting the self-loan program. This is from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill. This is a House-only provision. At R55 to R56, these are changes to the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Program from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill. These are identical between the two bodies. I will note that the Senate does have unique language on R56, but the committee could adopt the House language and save the Senate-only additions that are on page R56 for another day, if that is what it chooses to do.
Okay. Committee, are there any concerns, comments, or questions on that section? So that's R55 and 56 with the notations that Mr. Hopkins just said. This is about, okay, the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance. Okay, seeing none, Mr. Hopkins, I think we would take your recommendation as you stated it.
Madam Chair and members, the next item on R56, this is the Senate-only provision regarding the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grant Program. The Senate includes language clarifying that the supplemental assistance will be calculated separately in the fall, spring, and summer terms, and it also includes a minimum and maximum award amount for each college.
Okay, thank you. One second. Sorry, Mr. Hopkins. So I was just going to ask the Senate the reason behind the differences, because this is very, very similar, but it's just the differences between adding the fall, spring, and summer terms. And I'm wondering if that was something that was asked for, or if you could offer some more advice. Chair Fate.
Yeah, so this is just, a technical change to make sure that White Earth, which has more summer enrollment, gets their amount as well.
Okay. Any concerns on the House side? These are very similar. I mean, it's a very small difference. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so the House increases the appropriation for this program somewhat, which makes the maximum award amount that's specified in the Senate language not really applicable given the House's appropriation. So that part of the Senate's item should probably be left until the appropriation for this program is finalized.
Thank you. So we will just set the whole part aside until we get full targets and note that we've already talked a little bit about the first part of that, about the clarifying language of fall, spring, and summer terms. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, at R56 to R57, there are two sections from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill that are identical between the two bodies that make changes to the dual training grant program, and these specify that the certificates or diplomas or degrees earned under the program must come from accredited post-secondary education, post-secondary institutions, and this is an identical provision.
Okay, so this is also another same provision. Do we have any concerns, comments? Seeing none, is this something we're ready to adopt tomorrow? Senator, Chair Fateh.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you so much. I think OEE had some technical changes and maybe some concerns. If we can probably call them up to speak.
I think that would be very efficient. If a representative from OEE could come up, and we are on R56, 57, the dual training grants. I will note, Ms. Oliver, I did not say that. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Oliver. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to the committee again, Ms. Oliver. Wonderful to have you. And do you know where we are? The dual training grants, definition, eligibility, training provider, and it's R56-57 on my sheet. Ms. Oliver.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I am the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement. And when I'm paying attention, hopefully I'm paying attention to the right stuff. So for this section, I think this is where we're changing adding accredited to pieces. So we're only supposed to be adding accredited to one part of the section. I think we've added accredited to too many parts of the section. I don't have my notes right in front of me, unfortunately. I apologize. So I can send it to your nonpartisan staff, the exact place where we're just supposed to be adding accredited to one section, because adding it to the other sections does not make sense for the types of training and programs. We will then be eliminating a whole host of training providers if we do add accredited. I think for some of the programs and certificate trainings, like some of the IT trainers, they are not accredited. So we don't want to add that phrase to the beginning of some of those programs. That's what I've been told by the training providers and DLI. So we don't want to do that. So that is what note. So
thank you, Ms. Oliver. Any other questions? Okay. And I think our nonpartisan are tracking you, and you'll send them that specific language differences. We will set this one aside until we get further instruction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver.
Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Hopkins, moving forward.
Madam Chair and members, on page R57, this is a House-only provision regarding the dual training grants. It increases the required cost of training match for large employers from 25% to 50% of the cost of training. On R57 is another House-only provision affecting the dual training grant program. And this doubles the maximum grant amounts available under the program. The House doesn't make any change to the appropriation as a result of this policy change. Next, this is a number of sections on R58 to R63. These are from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill. And these make technical and administrative changes to the Private and Out-of-State Public Post-Secondary Education Act. This also has the fee increases that are reflected in the spreadsheet discussed earlier. Other than technical differences, which you can see on page R60 between the two bodies, these sections are all identical. Regarding those technical differences, nonpartisan staff recommend the House language.
Thank you. Senator Putnam has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry for making us to go back a little bit, but if we could go back to the dual training grant amounts
provision that the House offers, doubling the maximum grant amounts available under the program. Does the House have any concern that this might disproportionately benefit larger employers rather than smaller ones? Is that a potential concern that might be a result of this change?
So, Senator Putnam, that was, so if you put the two items in totality, what we're asking is large employers, as you alluded to, that instead of a 25% match, we're asking them to do a 50% match. But then we're also doubling the amount that can be the grant amount. So we're trying to balance it because we knew that if the large employers, like the hospitals and others that really like this program, if we're going to double the amount that they can do the grant, we said, well, you're going to have to do a bigger match.
Very cool. Thanks for the clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to say that, and then I thought, well, I'll just wait. But I'm so glad you asked the question because I was going to offer that as context.
Let me know if you'd like me to pitch any more softballs. Just tug on your ear, and I'll either steal second base or ask an easy question.
You can do that anytime, and I would gladly appreciate it. Thank you. And really, I want this to be a conversation because I want every single member to be very involved in crafting this bill because we all represent our caucuses, and it's a really important job for each of us to represent our caucus as well. Okay, with that, was there any... Let's see, where were we at? Okay, we were at, so R 58 through 73, and these are mostly the same with small technical changes and comes from the OHE policy bill. Is there any questions or concerns, or does OHE have any concerns about this section that we're not aware of right now? Okay, I'm not seeing anything. Okay. So we will, can we conditionally accept or adopt this tomorrow, Senator or Chair Fattay? I think we're all good. Okay, so this comes from the OHE policy bill. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, the next sort of similar group of changes is at R63 to R73. These changes affect the Private Career School Act regarding OHE's licensure of those institutions. This is from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill. It includes increases to fees that are reflected on the spreadsheet, except for some minor technical differences. The sections are largely identical. I would just note that on page R63, the House includes the policy statement that was in the office's agency bill, and the Senate does not.
Okay, members, anything in this section that we have concerns, questions, you need more clarification? Is vastly the same with one small change, difference, I mean. Okay, and I hope OHE just signals us if they have something more. I'm looking at Ms. Oliver over there. Okay.
Tomorrow.
Okay, she says tomorrow. All right, so committee, can we conditionally adopt this tomorrow? Unless any other things arise from today till tomorrow. Okay, we will do that tomorrow. Continue, Mr. Hopkins.
So, Madam Chair, that concludes all of the same and similar language in Article 2. Moving on to page R73. This is a Senate-only provision. It's from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill, and it removes a requirement for the Office of Higher Education to gather Minnesota institutions' dual credit acceptance policies. The next change is on R75. So both the bodies make a change from the Office of Higher Education's agency bill to the Spinal Cord and Traumatic Brain Injury Research Grant Program statute that specifies what kind of institutions can receive those grants. However, the House position is unique in that it does not include for-profit organizations in making them eligible for the grants. Otherwise, the two sections are identical.
And I would just note for the Senate that the reason that was is we had a wonderful new member to the Higher Ed Committee, Representative Liebling, who is a hawk when it comes to all of these things. And so she looked at that, and we did agree with her because we put it in the bill that this should be going to not be going to for-profit organizations, and so that is why it is there. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, the remaining provisions are all Senate-only provisions. On page R75 are two Senate-only provisions affecting the University of Minnesota's University Fund. These amend the statutes governing how the funds are distributed out of the Permanent University Fund and make a technical change regarding the name of one of those funds. On R77 is a Senate-only provision amending the Disabled Veteran Landscape Arboretum Statute, which allows disabled veterans to bring one guest free of charge. Also on R77 is an additional provision within the health sections of statute regarding opiate antagonists.
I would also, sorry, Mr. Hopkins, I would also note that that provision is being carried in the House Health Bill. So just make that note as well. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Please continue. We're almost done.
On R78 is a Senate-only provision regarding the small issue pool allocation for bonding. The Senate includes an OHE recommended provision that increases the amount available to the Office of Higher Education through the small pool bond allocation program from $10 million to $25
million. And I would just ask the Senate, again, that was something that we hadn't heard in the House, what was the need to increase it from $10 million to $25 million? Chair Fattah.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. That was based off of a recommendation from OHE.
Okay. All right. Any other questions about that change? Okay. Please continue, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, on R79, Senate-only provision regarding the surplus appropriation for state grant programs. The Senate suspends application of that subdivision, which permits OHE to increase state grant awards in the event of a surplus appropriation. That's on R79. Finally, the final section on R79 is a Senate-only provision establishing a working group to develop policy recommendations to prevent fraudulent enrollment in MinState online courses.
Thank you. So any questions on the sections that we just went over from House or Senate wanting clarification? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered if the Senate could just discuss a little bit more about why they want to prevent surplus awards for the state grant if we're ever fortunate to be in that position.
Chair Fattah.
Thank you so much. Are you talking about R79?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Robbins. It's just when we had more one-time money, so we'd like to roll that over to mitigate any of the rationing in details that could occur.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So would that just apply to each biennium, or would that apply going well into the future?
Chair Fattah.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins. 26-27 biennium.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Bush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, the inclusions in the Senate bill for state grant parameter changes and the increased appropriation leave a positive balance in the state grant program at the end of fiscal year 2027. Under the Office of Higher Education's kind of standard surplus and rationing procedures, they don't do that until the second year of the biennium. So with excess funds available, they would use their surplus procedures and have nothing left to carry into the next biennium. But the Senate bill offers extended availability for that appropriation until fiscal year 2029. So if we want there to be anything left for them to carry into fiscal year 2029, we have to suspend the surplus procedures and allow that money to carry forward.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other concerns? Okay. Yes, Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Madam Chair and members. I just also wanted to ask the Senate about the working group for MinState on recommendations for fraudulent enrollment for online courses, and I very much appreciate that. But to the earlier point, we had a discussion about Go students, and it seems to be not limited to online students, and it certainly doesn't seem to be limited to the MinState system. So I wondered if you would be open to that being a broader working group.
Chair Fattay.
Thank you so much. So in committee, we heard specifically from this issue around asynchronous online courses. I think in one of the programs within Century College specifically, they found, I think, 50% of a course was Go students. So this seems to be like an online program, but I'm happy to have a healthy discussion around this with other members in the committee.
Thank you. Okay. Any other comments, questions, or concerns from members? Seeing none, we will move to testimony. That's what everyone's been waiting for. Okay. First up, we have Commissioner Olson. After that, we have Christine Keel from the University of Minnesota. And after that, Tracy Tomey from the Cannabis Research Center. So that's 1, 2, and 3. Welcome back again, and thank you so much for being here, Commissioner Olson. We very much appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you, Chair Rarick, and good afternoon, Chairs Rarick, Wolgamont, Fattay, and conferees. For the record, again, my name is Dennis Olson, serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Thank you for the opportunity to address the conference committee to share a few comments on the provisions of both the House and Senate education or higher education bills. I previously submitted letters and testified in both higher education committees prior to markup and passage. And for the most part, my comments today are consistent with previous testimony. And I want to just first start by thanking both committees for considering and including many of the governor's budget and policy recommendations in the bill, particularly those that address the projected shortfall in the Minnesota State Grant Program. And I also want to thank both committees for prioritizing our agency administration request, allowing us, of course, to continue to maintain our commitment to providing outstanding service to students and campus community partners, and, of course, providing key information to the legislature. We do have a few concerns in the bill, particularly related to some of the proposed reductions and elimination of funding. We see that both committees reduced several programs that were not recommended by the governor for reduction or elimination. And it appears that the intent was to find additional resources for the state grant program. But rather than follow a more balanced approach, and you'll hear me say that a couple more times, the committee chose to significantly reduce or eliminate critical and necessary supports that complement core financial aid programs. There's several reductions within both bills, but most concerning is $4 million reduction in the Student Parent Support Initiative in the House bill. And of course, the small $60,000 reduction in the state Get Ready appropriation, which acts as the state's match contribution that unlocks over $30 million in federal gear up grants. And so reducing that appropriation may impact our ability to appropriately administer that federal grant, which is particularly concerning in this unstable federal education environment. I do want to just focus the remainder of my testimony today on encouraging the conference committee to strongly consider the most well-balanced and least disruptive approach to the Minnesota State Grant Program to ensure the most sustainable and predictable awards for students in the upcoming biennium, continue and in future years as well. I recognize that I'm not before a federal congressional committee today, but a lot has changed at the federal level within even the last couple of weeks. You know, I feel strongly about approaching a state grant program with both parameter changes and investment, but given the news in the last couple of weeks, we need some flexibility as well. We need the ability to stay nimble and responsive as possible throughout the ever-changing financial aid landscape. We're going to need a balance of statutory parameter changes like those proposed by the governor, and thankfully, thanks to the work of both committees, they are reflected, although in a little bit different way, in both of the bills, so really appreciate that. You know, like I mentioned just a second ago, in addition, we do need flexibility. Since we were before the committees and we did markup and passage, the Trump administration, as well as components of the proposed House budget reconciliation process, proposed to dramatically shift the Pell Grant program, the federal Pell Grant program, and these all have the potential to greatly disrupt even further the state grant program and North Star Promise unless we take some action. We noted previously Pell Grant is facing a $2.7 billion shortfall in 25 right now. That balloons to over $10 billion in fiscal 26. There's proposed eligibility changes to Pell as well as the award formula. We expect many of those have the support at the federal level to pass. Just a few examples really quickly for the committee to consider. There's currently a proposal to define full-time as 15 credits. Students who currently take 12 credits are considered full-time for a Pell Grant and are eligible for the Max Pell Award. Changing this definition would result in a $1,479 cut to the Max Pell Award for students who take less than 15 credits. By the way, that's about a quarter of all students that get a Pell Grant, according to NCAN. So their Pell Grant will go from $7,395 to $5,916. In addition to that proposed change, any student not enrolled at least half-time, so that's 7.5 credits, would be now ineligible for a Pell Grant, essentially eliminating federal aid for part-time students. This is, of course, disproportionately impacts adult students, student parents, which we talked about, students that are close to completion, and those that require part-time enrollment. Pell Award parameters are also proposed to change around the cost of attendance calculation by program and major. This disproportionately impacts students by forcing them to the private loan market. And there's an introduction of short-term Pell for short-term training programs, and it doesn't have a current pay-for appropriation or provision. So this new eligibility will put a strain on current resources, and there's concerns about program quality as well. So again, I want to thank both committees for including nearly all the governor's recommended policy provisions, especially those intended to improve the process and program approval timelines of our licensing and registration division, as well as increase student and consumer protection. One other federal item of note, there was an executive order issued last month that outlined some major changes to institutional accreditation, including softening regulations and inviting new accreditors into the space. Now, there's some potential benefits here we've been talking to our partners about, but those that are leading the charge for the change have been associated with previously terminated accreditors that have been associated with now closed institutions that have defrauded students. Some of the members here served on higher ed when we, at the state level here, had to navigate the abrupt closure of Argosy University that left about 1,000 Minnesota students high and dry while we had to work through the courts to recover state financial aid resources, taxpayer funds. And since state higher education agencies are one of the three members of the regulatory triad, we may very well have significantly more work to do to protect students in the near future. At the same time, there's proposals around safeguard consumer protection programs like closed school discharge and borrower defense that are poised for elimination as well, meaning fewer protections for federal and state resources. So our role at the Office of Higher Education to protect Minnesota institutions, students, and financial aid resources is absolutely critical now more than ever. Madam Chair, members, again, thank you for recognizing the budget and policy recommendations for the governor and including them. We know there's still items to work through, further conversation here at the conference committee, and we look forward to working with the committee and other stakeholders as the bill moves through. So appreciate the maybe little extra time here today as we kick off testimony. Thank you so much.
Commissioner, you always get more time. Absolutely. Chair Fattay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Olson. I have about a dozen questions. No, not at all. I'm joking. I only have one question. First, it was awesome to work with you, just like at last biennium this year, and helping craft the Senate position, the House position. So I appreciate your hard work, Commissioner. My question is around Line 8, the Get Ready program. In your testimony right now, you indicated that with the House cuts, we would save, I think, around $60,000 for the biennium, but that money could potentially unlock $30 million in federal funds. Is that correct?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Fattay, that is correct. We have a small state appropriation that acts as the state match for the federal Gear Up program, which in Minnesota we call Get Ready. So trimming that appropriation essentially, you know, puts that entire $30 million federal award at risk. And that's a brand new award we just received recently.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I hope we can reconsider that and discuss it the next couple of days. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Fattay. We definitely will discuss that. Yes. Any other questions for the Commissioner? I won't do this every time, but Commissioner is a little special. Okay, seeing none. Thank you so much, Commissioner. I appreciate your availability as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And quick PSA, there is a earbud up here if someone's missing one.
Got you. Commissioner, she's yours. Christine Keel from the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee again. Very glad to have you here. Please state your name for the record. And we'll give you 3 minutes unless you need more, because you are the University of Minnesota. So we respect that as well.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I trimmed it down given time, though, to get even under less than that. So, Madam Chair, Chairs Fattay and Wolgamott, members of the conference committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Christine Keel, Interim Director of Government Community Relations at the University of Minnesota. We want to express our sincere appreciation for the committee's continued support of higher education in Minnesota. We recognize fully the fiscal challenges the state is facing, and are deeply grateful for the university's base funding of operations and maintenance being maintained. That support is essential to our ability to serve students and communities across Minnesota. We also want to express our support for a provision in the Senate bill that provides additional funding to NRRI. It's in alignment with the Board of Regents priorities, and it utilizes new funding that are not general fund dollars. At the same time, I will highlight our concerns regarding the eliminations that you heard about as you did the walkthrough to several of our state special accounts. The university does not have sufficient discretionary resources to absorb these cuts internally, and without that additional support, we will be forced to scale back or in some cases fully sunset those longstanding programs that have had meaningful statewide impact. My colleagues from the Cannabis Research Center and the Bell Museum, when they have their turns to testify, they will explain a little bit more of those impacts. Much like Commissioner Olson, we also want to recognize the uncertainty at the federal level and what that could mean for our institution. So your state support is more meaningful than ever. In our newly redone economic impact statement report that we have, for every $1 in the state of fund, from the state the university receives, we generate $16.75 in economic impact return to the state. We remain steadfast in our commitment to being transparent and responsible with our public funding. Our goal is always to deliver the greatest possible benefit to Minnesotans through education, research, and outreach. And we thank you for your partnership, again, in maintaining our base funding. And we look forward to continuing to work with you as we conclude this session.
Thank you, Ms. Keel. I'm wondering if you could let us know, you had said that some of those programs may need a sunset. Can you be a little more specific as to which ones would be affected the most? Because as we walk through that with the Senate fiscal, it sounds like all of those specials and riders were, the base appropriations were deleted in totality, and I'm wondering where is the most effect for the University of Minnesota?
Yeah, it will be the Minnesota Geological Survey, the Talented Youth Mathematics Program, the Humphrey Forum, and the Center for Economic Development, and then again, you'll hear from the Center for Cannabis Research and the Bell Museum on those impacts.
And Ms. Keel, I believe those are all of the appropriations that were eliminated. So would they all have to, I'm just going from my memory. Are there some that would remain, that would continue and not be sunsetted then?
Madam Chair, there is some reductions, not complete eliminations, and we would continue that. My colleague also from the Mayo will address some of those reductions and eliminations that we will see in our partnership with them as well.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. I just want to make sure I understand that testimony as accurately as possible. I know we're looking at things that are simply being proposed, but is it the university's testimony here today that if they do not receive the funding for these programs that they will for sure go away, or has the university done some analysis to say that they can make some changes internally to still fund or cover some of these programs, or is it too early to tell?
Ms. Keel.
Madam Chair and Senator Duckworth, for the programs I specifically named, the Geological Survey, that's a program we do on behalf of the state, and so we do not put internal funds towards that, so that will go away. Same with the Talented Youth Math, and same with, the Geological Survey and the Mathematics Program, and then the Humphrey Program as well.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony, but stay tuned because I have questions later.
No. Madam Chair, we will be here. Thank you.
And I think I've already submitted my questions to you. So when we get that back in the next few days, that's very helpful.
Yes, Madam Chair, we received that from your committee administrator and we are working on that.
I look forward to that. That helps us inform our decisions. Thank you so much. So next up is Tracy Tomey from the Cannabis Research Center. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you'll have 2 minutes for your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, Chair Fateh and Chair Wogomat. My name is Tracy Toomey. I'm the director of the Cannabis Research Center at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. Funding to develop the center was part of the 2023 legislation that legalized adult cannabis use. This is one of the costs associated with legalization that should be offset ultimately by the cannabis the tax on the cannabis sales. The charge of the center is to conduct independent research to assess health effects related to cannabis legalization and cannabis, as well as many other things, including treatment, prevention, and education related to cannabis. The goal of this center from day one has been to serve and provide value to the state. And all of our funding does come from the state. You may ask, why is state funding of the Cannabis Research Center so important? First, it enables the center to do research in Minnesota for Minnesota. Second, it allows the center to do research focusing on health effects, but also on implementation of legalization. Some of the questions we can ask and answer are, what is working? What can be improved? What training and assistance is needed? Third, it allows the center to be very nimble. We can launch a research project within a month or two, which provides more real-time research information in the state related to cannabis. And finally, we collect needed local and state data, data that may be needed for some of the state reports, given the pauses in some of the surveys at the federal level, as well as needed local level data that's needed for prevention work. Many in Minnesota have expressed how valuable the Cannabis Research Center is to them. You may have seen that in the many letters of support that were submitted for today. This includes people who are worried about cannabis use among children, teens, young adults, and seniors, people who are concerned about the connection between cannabis use and mental health and nicotine use, public health and educational workers who are dealing with on the front lines with implementation of cannabis legalization and the effects of legalization. And I point out that there is a real direct relevance to higher ed because the college students and college age people are the highest users, most prevalent users of cannabis. So there's very great concerns in higher ed. This is not the time to stop the critical research that is needed right now in Minnesota related to cannabis. We have over 4,000 stores that are registered to sell the hemp THC products, and the dispensaries will open up soon across the state. When the Cannabis Research Center has been asked for help, we have always said yes, because we are funded by the state. The center will not be able to say yes without continued funding. We probably will not exist. I thank the House for including the center in their budget. And I urge all the conference committee members to figure out a way to continue funding the Public Health Cannabis Research Center at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I have a quick question for you. So how many are employed at the center? And can you just let us know when the funding started? And is your entire budget within our higher ed budget?
So our entire budget, yes, is within the higher budget. Higher ed budget, as I understand it. I've been learning this as we go. And we have, it's a moving target about how many people we have, faculty, staff, and students. At the moment, I think we're around 15 or 16 people of varying effort. And there was a third part of the question, I'm sorry, I think.
Yeah, there was. Let me think, what was my question? Yes, the funding. So I asked you, but you answered that. Does all the funding come from the higher ed bill? And how many members are, when did the funding start? That was the question. Thank you.
So it was part of the 2023 legislation. So funding technically started in, I think, August 1st of 2023. Okay. Did I get the date right? I was the first person that was officially appointed to the center, and I started in October 2023, and that's when we launched.
Thank you. Any member questions? So this is very different from House and Senate, and I will just note that because it looked like in our spreadsheet that this was a transfer, and technically it was from the cannabis bill, but it did come out of the general fund. And so it was a little confusing for us on the House side. We didn't have much of a conversation about it on the House side. Any House members have questions? Because we really didn't talk about this provision very much. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Toomey. I really appreciate you coming, and I just want to say from my perspective that the work they do is very valuable for the state. We have relied on their research, or at least I have, as a policymaker. They put out a study earlier this year that showed how significant in Minnesota underage use of THC beverages has been, and it was what prompted me to offer an amendment in the House, which didn't go through, but they're doing real-time work in a program that's just getting off the ground in Minnesota. So as the legalization takes off, we will have real data to understand the impact, especially on youth, and I think that's very important. And also, I've worked with them separately and some other areas of the University of Minnesota Research Lab on helping to develop, hopefully, a roadside impairment test for cannabis. And so I think your work is very valuable, and I hope we can find a way to continue it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Mr. Hopkins, would you remind the committee like how this came to be and how it ended up in our bill? Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so it's in 2023 session laws, Chapter 63, this appropriation to the University of Minnesota for the cannabis research program within the School of Public Health.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And this was intentionally, it was supposed to be funded through the sale, so the tax on the sale of cannabis, which hasn't started yet, and so then it transformed into a general fund appropriation. Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair, just a point of clarification, the appropriation in the Chapter 63 was a general fund appropriation, so it counted against that target for the cannabis bill, just like if this committee were to decide to appropriate money to the DNR, that would count against the conference committee's target, but then over the summer that would be incorporated in the next forecast to, say, the environment bill.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. See, this is how confusing it is, even for me. So, okay, any other questions from members? Okay, seeing none, thank you so much for coming and for your testimony today.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have Mr. Ullman from Minn State. After that, we have Sydney Spreck from MAPE. And after that, Rob Wudlick from the GUSU 2 Care Paralysis. Mr. Ullman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony. I'll give you 3 minutes because you are the Minn State system. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Rarick, Chair Fateh, Chair Wolgamont, Confreys. My name is Bernie Ullman with Minnesota State Colleges. First of all, just thank you for listening to our campuses, our students, and our communities over the past few months. And also coming into session, our board leadership and leadership of our campuses certainly understood the financial position the state is in, and also the troubles and the financial difficulties of the state grant. And given that context, I just want to thank you and members of the conference committee for your internal advocacy to have a higher ed target that may increase some or at least holds us harmless. I know that was a heavy lift by a number of you. Just want to say thank you for your interest in the cybersecurity, adding that to our portfolio. We appreciate that, and I was able to cover the Lake Superior College issue, and just want to let you know that we're also fishing in other ponds. We're not just coming to you with our problems. We're looking both at federal and other environmental funds, and I just want to say with the budget and what is presented to us at the end of the day, no matter kind of where this goes, it's going to be a difficult road with the financial pressures that our campuses are going to have. And we appreciate you giving us space to make some of those decisions, and also know that we kind of believe that we know that we're in this together with you, and we look forward to continuing that conversation. And finally, let me just, like Commissioner Olson said, I know I'm not testifying in front of a congressional panel, but I just want to double down on what he said. We've been working very hard on stating our cases as this reconciliation process goes forward. Now we have that process, and then we have the actual FY26 process coming forward, where there's a number of programs that are being targeted that many of you know very well, such as TRIO, that we're going to support. But the immediate concerns around the Pell eligibility for part-time students affects our students significantly for adult learners. We have over 7,000 students that would be slated to lose the Pell Grant. That's $10 million. And whether or not that's a total hit on the students or it bounces right on the North Star promise, there is going to be significant consequences if we don't try to you know, get our voices out to our delegation, and we're certainly doing that. And obviously the House will pass their bill, and we're hopeful that the Senate will shave some of the concerns away as it relates to the eligibility on the Pell. And that is a vulnerable population, again, adult learners, folks that we are driven to serve in our system. And, you know, we look forward to that advocacy, but it's something I think as leaders of the legislature and higher ed, we're going to be talking about certainly between now and next session and beyond. So thank you for your time, and we appreciate it. The work you're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Allman. We have Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allman, as you know, when you're making policy around issues like this, it's important to have accurate information. And sometimes we hear a lot of noise. Sometimes we take the noise for truth. Like, for example, I've heard people say that Minnesota State is likely to raise tuition by 18% next year. I hear that. I know that's crap. Could you talk about that a little bit and give us some truth and some clarity on the issue of the reality around Minnesota State's approach to tuition, but also the likelihood of what tuition increases might be, if they're necessary?
Mr. Allman.
Chair Rarick and Senator Putnam. So thank you for the question. First of all, I just want to make it clear that because of the support and work at the legislature and a lot of advocates over the past 10, 12 years, our tuition increases have been well below the rate of inflation. I think at our two-year campuses over the last 10 years, our rate of increase has been something like 1.3%. At the four-year campuses, it's like 2%, and that's not, you know, all on us. I'm giving credit to where credit is due to those folks that write the budgets and also push us hard on college affordability, and we get that. Where we are right now, and I take a minute or two of that, our board chair, George Soule, many of you know him, has the same passion as this committee now does for transparency. And at the April board meeting, he decided, and with obviously the chancellor, that let's have an open discussion about scenarios. And they brought in scenarios of 3%, 5%, 7%, and 9%. And then, of course, the headline was Minnesota State is considering an 18% increase over the biennium. That's not where that board is going. I don't know for sure where this all ends up. We're at a place where the consultation at the campuses with students is happening. And I would say that if I were to, you know, in hearing the conversations both with presidents, knowing where the chancellor would like to be, he's got to give his recommendation to the board in a couple weeks, the initial one for the first reading. And then in June, the board will make the final action. You know, kind of like the target you're looking at, one could imagine it's going to end up somewhere in the middle of all these discussions. And I think it's also important to know that where we are at with our inflationary pressures at the campus level, we don't control all of them. And we don't know what they're going to be. But the board has got to make a decision on the revenue stream in a few weeks or a few months. So that's not unlike, you know, those of you that have served on school boards and have to deal with that dynamic. But that's what we're kind of grappling with. And my guess kind of where this thing will end up is going to be a place where everybody's going to be a little upset. I don't think you're going to see nines or eights or anything like that. I would say that the board leadership certainly shares this committee's passion for student affordability, and they recognize that this bill does not contain tuition freeze language, and I think they also recognize that they have to make responsible decisions and continue to communicate and be your partner for that to continue in the future. But together, I think it's important to remember that the work that from Representative Nornes, Representative Bernardi, Representative Pawlowski, and you know, Senator Anderson and so on, Senator Fatte, obviously, that advocacy and that work got us to a place where, you know, you can report that tuition was roughly half of what inflation was over the last 10 to 12 years. And that has a lot to do with the great advocacy that our student organizations, faculty, and others have done.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much. Oh, I'm so sorry. You're right out of my line of sight. Chair Fatte.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ullman. I had to step away, so do you mind starting your testimony from the beginning? Is that okay? No. So my question is around what are you guys seeing around enrollment trends, especially at the two-year colleges, and what would be the future outlook, you would say, if we make cuts that disproportionately affects our 2 years and MinState?
Mr. Ullman.
Chair Rarick and Chair Fatte, as you know, over the past year, we have had significant tuition growth at many of our, particularly our two-year campuses and some of our four-year campuses. I think that average was around 7%. So that certainly is really, really good news. It helps somewhat in the financial area of running a campus. But, you know, as a president, I heard over and over as they were meeting over the past couple of days, there are certain majors, especially in career and tech or in nursing, that they lose money on every student they enroll. So it's kind of a weird dynamic that they're in just by the cost and the, you know, being able to, you know, make sure that the, you know, the different regulations by different outside boards are covered. So it is a great thing to have. We're using, as you drive around the state, you know, we're using the North Star Promise and other things to try to attract people. And as you know, the chancellor says very eloquently that our competition for students is not necessarily the privates or the University of Minnesota. We say it is at times, but it really is the students that are not checking in. And that's really what we're after, is the students that are not checking in that the workforce really, really needs. And that's why we're driven by workforce scholarships. We're driven by, you know, using North Star Promise and anything else that our campus can do to connect, because we're still hearing frustration with employers in every part of the state of wanting more. And they're looking to the pipelines and anything we can do to continue to do that. And that's why, you know, we really need to double down on the advocacy, and we will work closely alongside of Commissioner Olson at the federal level on some of those things that we believe really drive that adult learner into that space.
Thank you, Mr. Ullman. Thank you. Thank you again for all your testimony and your advocacy. Okay. Seeing no other comments or questions.
Madam Chair, my apologies for sounding too academic today. It's just not me.
That's wonderful. Okay, so now we have Sydney Spreck with MAPE. After that is Rob Wudlick. After that, we've got Mayo. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue their testimony of 2 minutes.
Chair, I'm asking if I'm able to switch out with Jess Schimmick, who was supposed to go number 12, but she has to leave in 5 minutes. So could we switch places?
Go right ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Jess Schimmick. And good afternoon, Chair Rarick, Chair Wolgamont, and Chair Fatte, and members of the conference committee. My name is Jess Schimmick, and I am a college lab assistant at Anoka Ramsey Community College in the Visual Arts Department. I'm also a member of AFSCME Council 5 and serve on my local's executive board. Thank you for considering my comments on the Higher Education Conference Committee. I'd like to start by thanking the chairs of both committees for crafting bills that don't limit the MinState and U of M systems from raising tuition in the absence of more general fund dollars. Well, there is no getting around the fact that consequences of this budget will be harmful for students, faculty, and staff. We certainly recognize that the forecast and your targets prohibit the kinds of investments I know you would all like to make. That being said, I want to express our concern about what such a small appropriation would do to the MinState system. Our colleges have made it clear to staff that the current budget outlook will necessitate tuition increases, program cuts, and massive staff layoffs. We are grateful that neither bill further restricts our public institutions with tuition caps, but we know that these fees can only go up so much without major enrollment consequences. More investment from the state is vital to mitigate the harm we know we will see, and we hope that the joint targets can accommodate that in the next few days. We do appreciate that both the House and Senate have made some changes to eligibility and scope of the state grant program. Addressing the shortfall is incredibly important, not just for MinState, but for the entire higher education system in Minnesota, and we appreciate the steps that you've proposed in both the House and Senate bills. We do ask that you continue to consider some of the other proposals that were heard in committee, particularly those that improve institutional equity between Minnesota State Universities and the U of M and private colleges, as well as consider limiting access for state grant dollars to students that attend for-profit private colleges. This would not only generate some savings for the state grant program, but it would also lend a clear message that predatory behavior towards students is unacceptable and we won't subsidize it. We encourage the conference committee to consider including that language. Finally, I just wanted to flag a small oversight in Article 2, Section 63 of the Senate bill. This is the Ghost Students Admission Work Group, and it names several of our sister unions for inclusion in this group. Our members do much of the processing work for student admission applications, and we feel that we would provide valuable feedback as the group comes up with recommendations to the legislature. We've spoken with the author of this, of the language, Senator Gustafson, as well as the Senate chair and staff, and we hope that we can be included as this bill moves forward. Thank you so much for your consideration today.
Thank you for your testimony. So next up, I'm going to reorder this just a little bit since we've kind of gone a little bit. So Rob Wedlick, and if there are anyone else, I believe there are two other folks that are here to testify on the same thing. If you want to make your way up and if you need help moving chairs, please do that. You got it. Wonderful. Okay, so that would be Maeve Olson, I believe, is probably the same subject. And let's see. Matthew Roderick is probably all of the same topic. So let's bring everybody up for that as well. Welcome to the committee.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. State your name for the record, and please give us your testimony. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Work and members of the committee. My name is Rob Wedlick. I'm a spinal cord injury advocate who broke his neck 14 years ago from a diving accident. Changed my life forever. I really want to express gratitude for the state's continued support for the Spinal Cord Brain Injury Research Grant Program and our strong advocates who have submitted written testimony and some who are here today too. It's really made a huge difference in a lot of people's lives, and we want to keep it. We want to keep the ball rolling. We want to keep the ball growing. So, and it is based on, you know, the core is the state funding. So, we bring in outside funding now quite a bit. So, but I'm really here to express my strongest opposition to the proposed house cut from $3 million a year to $500,000. So, $5 million cut. That's really significant. These cuts would dramatically hurt our research labs. The progress that we'd made, a lot of it would be halted, and we'd be taking a lot of steps back. And it would hurt the labs, or hurt the students, but it would really hurt people like me. You know, this is also the wrong timing, given all the kind of outside problems. We had a $40 million cut from a Department of Defense spinal cord research grant program. It's totally eliminated. So we really need this research, and it's also a good opportunity to pull really good talent into our state. I've heard from researchers that they're thinking about moving to Minnesota. So you know, imagine being stuck in bed, not being able to feed yourself, watching your friends kind of live their normal lives, or not being able to breathe or having your skin feel like it's on fire. We've made changes to all these things. Spinal cord stimulation, we have people walking, moving their legs. Not everyone, but most people are moving their legs, and a lot of autonomic functions that really impact our lives. Now that's a reimbursed thing because of this grant program. And over 70 people have been implanted with spinal cord injuries. People come in from out of the state for this. Non-invasive spinal cord stimulation was approved for upper extremity and arm function for spinal cord injury in December. A lot of that research came from Minnesota because of this program. We've developed groundbreaking treatments for neuropathic pain with kind of this proprioceptive kind of therapy. And that wouldn't have been funded by a federal agency. Now it is, because we've proven that it works. And we're also researching women's health after spinal cord injury, something that is really commonly overlooked, and it creates a lot of problems. And, you know, a lot of this research is translatable for many other conditions. You know, a neurological injury is kind of a root cause of a lot of problems that we all suffer. So, you know, we've been basically a global hotbed for research now in spinal cord and brain injury research. And, you know, there's a really strong business case for this too. We pull in federal and private grant funds quite a bit more than the state puts in. There's an educational advantage. We're a great training site, and we support spinal cord research. Several companies have also kind of spiraled off some of these grants that are pretty successful too, and changing people's lives in the hospital and in clinics. You know, this program's a little different too. I just want to point out that I'm a board member. Matthew Roderick here is a board member on the council. We're people that live this injury every day. Matthew's a father, he'll tell you, of somebody with a spinal cord injury. And we help make these decisions. So really we have the interests of the community in mind. And it's not kind of an elite few that make these decisions. So we'd hope that we continue to see support. And I'd also just want to take a second to address the small business policy change. And we intentionally left that in because we acknowledge that small businesses are kind of a direct way to translate research. And so usually it's kind of an end stage. So this is a bit of a seed fund for people to kind of translate these solutions to the community pretty fast. And it really only represents a small portion of the overall grant funding. So I thank you for your time and consideration, and please save our funding. So
thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'll turn to the next testifier. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is...
Give you 2 minutes because we are
sure,
getting
I'll be
quite
quick.
Long.
My name is Matthew Roderick, and I am the executive director at Unite to Fight Paralysis. As Rob mentioned, I'm father to a son with a spinal cord injury. And though I do not have an MD or a PhD to my name, I just wanted to let you know I have been invited to speak at NIH, then the Society for Neurotrauma, the Society for Neuroscience, American Spinal Injury Association, the International Spinal Research Trust. I've spoken at dozens of universities around the United States and Canada. I know this field very well as a result of being the father to a son with a spinal cord injury and being very systems-minded. There is a problem in biomedical research and the academic research enterprise. And that problem, especially in small conditions, is translation of discoveries to application. That's what this bill was designed for and to do. And as Rob mentioned, it is very unique because it places people who have lived experience like us, along with experts in the field, research and clinical, to drive discoveries out of the lab and into people. I'll give you one little anecdote that I think is very important to elucidate this. Not too long ago, I was talking with a leading neuroscience researcher in SCI who was recounting to me, said, last week I had my performance evaluation. Do you know what I was not asked? And I paused and said, I think you probably were not asked what you discovered this past year. And this person uncomfortably laughed and said, yes, I was asked, where did I publish? How much did I publish? What grants did I get? And where did my students come from? And where did they go when they left? All those things are important to the academic research ecosystem, but they do not equal translation to our community. That's what this program was designed to do. And as Rob elucidated, it is doing that. People with spinal cord injuries having orgasms for the first time, being able to go to the bathroom without a catheter or without extra interventions to have a bowel program, standing, reduction of neuropathic pain, reduction of spasticity, all of these things that come attendant with a spinal cord injury, like my son has all of them. The WHO considers the worst, second worst acquired disease in the world is a high cervical injury that Rob has. The worst in all its respects, economically, socially, the drain on the system. And the reason why we come to you all is because the cost of care for our community is exorbitant. There are 10,500 people living with spinal cord injury in this state. It costs about $65,000 on average to care for them. 70% of them are unemployed, and so you have a cost. That cost is being reduced. We have people in clinical trials, hundreds of people in clinical trials, that are getting restored function that turn into a reduction of cost of care. And the last thing I'll say, because none of you, I assume, have that personal intimacy with the injury, there's an economic return. We have exported this program to Ohio, Pennsylvania, Washington, modeled after Minnesota's program, and we are soon to pass in the next month, we hope, in Wisconsin. Because the return on investment by what we have collected is a modest 5 to 6 to 1. There are cases of 20 to 1. Researchers at the University of Minnesota getting a seed grant for $45,000, turning it around to an NIH grant of $2.3 million.
Thank you, Mr. Roderick. We're way over time. That's,
thank you.
That's but almost 10 minutes.
Please
so.
Protect that funding
thank
as
you.
A result of what we've
thank
given
you.
And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Maeve Olson is, I believe, the same topic. So if you want to come up and... state your name for the record, and please,
yes,
just
hi.
2 minutes. We have,
yeah,
we've been
absolutely.
Here since three, so.
Absolutely.
Two minutes,
my name
please.
Is Maeve Olson. I'm the public policy coordinator with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, whose mission is to raise awareness and enhance the quality of life for all people affected by brain injury. I'm here today to urge you to support the Senate's position of fully funding the Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Research Grant Program, budget line item number 29. And to not support the cuts that were proposed in the House version. These competitive research grants, they are really key investments for our state to continue in order to see the progress and improvements in some of the most complex medical disabilities our society sees, as was mentioned. New information and innovations in this area have the potential to positively impact individuals, but also our broader society, and we've heard so much of that. Already. So I just want to say thank you so much to our other testifiers. So please continue to fund this important research at $3 million per year. And thank you for your time, consideration, and opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming to share. Any quick questions from members? Okay, seeing none. Thank you so much for your testimony. So next up, we have Mayo Clinic, Nikki Valenderk, if she wants to come up. And then I believe if the representative from MAPE wants to circle back, or if you want to wait till later, I'm not sure where she went. Okay. So after Mayo, if MAPE wants to come up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and if you could do it in 2 minutes, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair and members. Nice to see you again. I am Nikki Valender with Mayo Clinic Government Relations. As I shared last time, Mayo Clinic is the oldest and largest integrated medical group practice in the world. We are also a nonprofit committed to patient care, research, and education, and are also the largest private employer in Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you again. As when I spoke to your respective committees in the past weeks, I wanted to highlight a few proven programs for your consideration and continued funding. Mayo has an extensive education portfolio, and I've appreciated the opportunity for you to hear about some of that this year. And we are appreciative of two tracks that the state has supported for the recent years. One being to the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. The funding appropriated through this line item goes directly to students and support as they begin their med school endeavors in hopes of being future providers. The other is related to family medicine residency, which is a type of graduate medical education. Mayo Clinic is
is very proud and of the responsibility we have and privilege to provide and do so extensively GME, and we appreciate the benefit that this has even beyond Mayo Clinic locations in the state. So as you're considering your final budget proposal, would sincerely ask for your reconsideration of those appropriations found on line 66 and 67 of your budget spreadsheet. And then I also wanted to turn to our research portfolio. I know you've heard about some of the great work of the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics, which is a partnership between the state, U of M, and Mayo Clinic. We really appreciate the Senate and Governor including ongoing funding for this partnership in their budgets, and hope that that will also be included in the final agreement before that comes out of your conference committee. I did want to make one thing known to you as well. The House has included a proposal brought forward by ALS patient advocates that would remove the remaining funding from the David Tomasoni ALS Research Program from OHE to the U of M with partnership with Mayo Clinic, and I know OHE was supportive of that effort. When Mayo and the U were asked as to, you know, what entity would be appropriate to oversee those funds, it was the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics, given we already have the structure established. And so I just wanted to flag that for you, that would be an intent as well of moving that funding there. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Not seeing any questions, so we'll bring up the representative from MAPE. Thank you so much. And after that, we're going to go to Paul Cirkvenik, and then after that, we're going to go to Rob Tipping from the Minnesota Geological Survey. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Sydney Spreck, and I am a political affairs coordinator at the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, or MAPE, which is a union of over 19,000 state workers across all of Minnesota's agencies, boards, and commissions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on the two higher education budget bills before the committee today. On behalf of MAPE, I would like to thank you for the work in both bodies to stabilize the state grant program and the inclusion of the governor's recommended operating adjustment for the Office of Higher Education. However, we are deeply concerned by the lack of substantially increased operations and maintenance funding for the Minnesota state system by both legislative bodies and the governor's office. Over 2,000 of our MAPE members work at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities across the state. These staff and campuses provide critical technical and vocational training that Minnesota's workforce desperately needs, while also supporting rural communities. Without the economic activities of these greater Minnesota campuses, many towns would struggle to prosper. With no new funding for the Minnesota state system, the campuses will need to raise tuition rates more than they already anticipate doing and place greater strain on some of the smaller greater Minnesota campuses that are struggling to remain open. I urge you to find funding that can be allocated towards the Minnesota state operations and maintenance so the campuses can start to work towards stabilization. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Cirkvenik, welcome back. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Chair Rarick, Wolgamott, and Fateh, committee members. My name is Paul Cirkvenik, and I serve as the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I want to begin by thanking conference committee members for the time you have given to our students, our presidents, and Allison and me throughout the session. We appreciate the time you have shared with us, and we know it means a lot to the students who come to the Capitol to be able to meet with their legislators who will have an impact on their education and to be able to testify before your committees. Our students could not be here today to testify because they are mostly in final exam mode. But many student leaders from our institutions have joined in a letter to the committee expressing their perspectives on the House and Senate bills. We're deeply grateful that both the House and the Senate have made the state grant a high priority this session. Your commitment to reducing the state grant program deficit and investing in the program will help over 80,000 students who will be enrolled in post-secondary institutions over the next 2 years. Thank you for this critically important commitment. Alleviating reductions to state grants will have an important impact on the students who face the highest financial barriers to earning a college degree. And their success will help make for a prosperous economic future for our state by providing the state with the talented workforce Minnesota needs in its healthcare, education, business, nonprofit, and public service sectors. I want to share just a few general thoughts about several provisions in the bill. We have shared our concerns with many of you about the unfairness of the proposed 1% tuition cap in the state grant program. We hope that the final bill will treat all students the same by recognizing the full tuition costs low-income students face wherever students choose to enroll, as the program has done for many years. As the committee considers the difficult choices and trade-offs related to the assigned family responsibility, the assigned student responsibility, and the negative SAI, we ask the committee to do as much as possible to keep all students' grants as close as possible to the level they were at in fiscal year 24, prior to the FAFSA changes and the subsequent rationing. And to the extent the changes are made to the assigned family responsibility or the assigned student responsibility, we hope these changes would be made temporary, not permanent, so that when there are adequate resources in the future, the AFRs and the ASR return automatically to the fair and longstanding levels they were at for all students prior to the shortfall. And we hope the conferees will maintain access for nonprofit and tribal institutions to apply for grants under the Post-Secondary Emergency Assistance Grant Program. Meeting these emergency needs is a priority for our colleges and universities and our student leaders. And we are grateful for the additional resources this program provides to students facing challenges or crises that could derail their educational journey. Finally, I just want to thank the committee and the committee staff and the OHE team for the work you are all doing under such difficult circumstances and budgetary constraints. We recognize the challenges you must deal with, and we appreciate your willingness to hear our views as you finalize this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cerfenik. Okay, we'll keep moving on here. Robert Tipping, this will be great. So we have the Minnesota Geological Survey. They've really wanted to come speak to us. So they are here. Thank you for sticking with us for many hours. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Chairs Fateh and Wolgamott, my name is Bob Tipping. I'm Director of Minnesota Geological Survey. I've asked Tony Runkle, my side here, lead geologist with the Geological Survey, along, just in case there are questions. In light of the comments that we've heard in the testimony of Christine Keel, I hope to be able to provide you with some information about who we are and what we do for the state. Thank you for this opportunity to express our concern about the Senate version of the higher education bill. Line 57 of the change items document entirely eliminates the appropriated state-based funding for Minnesota Geological Survey. Established in 1872, the MGS provides fundamental earth science information necessary for stewardship of the state's minerals and groundwater. This appropriation has been in place since 1961, and the level of funding of this appropriation has been consistently at this level since 2011. The state appropriation is 30% of the MGS's annual income, which is about 65% of our base funding. Zeroing out the state appropriation is the equivalent of 7 FTEs for a staff of about 30 people. So again, that does not include the potential loss of funding coming from inside base funding for the University of Minnesota. However, equivalent full-time estimates do not adequately represent the intent of the state appropriation or its impact on the services that MGS provides. As an example, in November of 2023, the EPA sent a letter petition for the nitrate levels in southeastern Minnesota. The state's response was prioritized based on which aquifers are impacted and is directly tied to the maps and reports that are provided by the MGS and funded by the state appropriation. The state appropriation helps save money. Regarding drinking water quality, the saying, and it's true, is that prevention is much less expensive than remediation. And funded by the appropriation, MGS time provided expertise on topics such as nitrate, PFAS, arsenic in drinking water, and helps answer questions including which aquifers are impacted and which aquifers are not. Olmsted County staff reported that the Olmsted County Geologic Atlas paid for itself many times over simply by providing a site that was safe for that landfill to be built in an otherwise karst terrain sensitive to groundwater pollution. regarding groundwater quantity, appropriation funding of the MGS time on technical advisory committees helps answer questions about aquifer properties, thicknesses, particularly for site-specific investigations. Is there water available for a project as it comes up? And if so, what do we know about that aquifer? For well contractors, how deep is it, or a target aquifer for a given location? Regarding mining, northern Minnesota deposits are valued at billions of dollars, and MGS mapping that provided the foundational information for the discovery was done at a cost of only a few hundreds of thousands of dollars. Identification of potential critical minerals is also dependent on MGS mapping. A recent report by the American Geosciences Institute shows that geologic mapping produces returns of about 7 to 10 times the initial cost of that map itself. By design, the legislature established the MGS through state appropriation to be part of the University of Minnesota to provide unbiased earth resources expertise and without a regulatory function. And again, I think that's important to consider on why we are at the University of Minnesota. The university provides an academic environment that supports the survey's mission of mapping and related geologic research and educating the public. MGS also gives university students exposure to practical geologic work, and this is all consistent with what we do as a public land-grant university. And I would just like to add, in general comment, what we found through this whole process is we're sort of a misfit in the higher education bills in many ways, although I think that there are things that we've just described that do apply to that. That said, what we're looking for is breathing room. We need to find a new way to fund the MGS and hopefully still remain within the University of Minnesota, for again, for the reasons that were outlined. So in order to do that, I think the urgency now of maintaining our base level funding through the state level appropriation gives us time in the next biennium to find a new way for that money to be coming out of the state. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any member questions? Okay, seeing none. So what I would like is if you could email me your total budget. You said that this would cut 7 FTEs, and I believe you said this was 30% of your budget was within our budget. If you could send that to me in an email so we can have that as part of our discussions.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
All right,
thank you so much for your testimony today. Okay, next up we've got Dr. Megan Walsh from Hennepin Healthcare. After that, we'll have Matt Shaver from Ed Allies. After that, we'll go to Casey Metcalf. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Walsh. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairs Rarick, Fateh, Wolgamott, and members of the conference committee. My name is Dr. Megan Walsh, and I serve as the Chief Academic Officer at Hennepin Healthcare. I want to begin by highlighting our gratitude for the historic support of Hennepin Healthcare's mission to teach the future physician workforce of Minnesota. I am here to testify on the Senate higher education proposal, which eliminates the addiction medicine fellowship and the family medicine residency funding that Hennepin Healthcare receives. The annual appropriation of $645,000 for our family medicine residency has supported teaching and training our next generation of primary care providers in Minnesota. This is one of the most expensive specialties to train, and this funding is critical to supporting our program director and faculty, whose time and expertise are required to ensure proper training across so many domains, from delivering babies to managing heart disease and cancers, from childhood illness to nursing home care. We graduate 11 doctors per year into family medicine for the state of Minnesota. Without this funding, we will be forced to reduce the number of residents we train in the midst of a worsening workforce shortage in primary care. The Addiction Medicine Fellowship annual appropriation of $270,000 funds the only Addiction Medicine Fellowship in Minnesota. Eliminating this funding would threaten the existence of the program and jeopardize the necessary care required to treat Minnesotans with life-threatening addiction. This program produces highly trained addiction professionals who serve the entire state, from Duluth to a myriad of tribal communities, as well as connecting care to 46 Minnesota counties through an addiction telemedicine curriculum called Project Echo. The problem is not that addictions are untreatable. The problem is that we do not have enough addiction-trained doctors offering life-saving treatment. I recognize you have difficult decisions to make with challenging budget realities, and I urge you to accept the House proposal that keeps this funding intact to ensure that we can continue training and retaining the workforce that Minnesota needs, in particularly in underserved areas. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Walsh. Any questions? Herps and Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, Dr. Walsh, for being here. I just want to point out for the committee that this is the second area where, after we legalized marijuana and we made commitments to research and provide for addiction, those were huge priorities at the time legalization occurred that we said we would fund to mitigate the harms. And now it looks like we're pulling back on a lot of these fronts, and it's disappointing. So I hope we can find a way to keep this in. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Any other member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Dr. Walsh. Thank you for hanging with us.
Thank you.
Next up, Mr. Shaver from Ed Allies. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Chair Rarick, Chair Wolgamott, Chair Fate, members of the conference committee, good evening. My name is Matt Shaver. I am the Senior Policy Director at Ed Allies. We're nonpartisan advocates for policies that improve student outcomes. Thank you for the opportunity to highlight a few components of the legislation in front of you. We're grateful to see both the House and Senate provide continued funding for direct admissions. We strongly urge the adoption of the Senate position to scale the program statewide by the end of this decade. Direct admissions is fundamentally about merit. A student's GPA automatically qualifies them for admissions at up to 57 Minnesota two-year and four-year public and private post-secondary institutions. Direct admissions is efficient in that it brings that information directly to students and their families, and direct admissions is effective in that in the one-fourth of high schools that participate, we see increases in FAFSA completion and in in-state college enrollment. Every student in Minnesota deserves this opportunity. This bipartisan policy, led in the House by Representative Mueller and in the Senate by Senator Gustafson, will do just that. Next, thank you to both House and Senate for ongoing investments in the Fostering Independence Grant. Investing in this population of students is morally the right thing to do and will pay dividends for our state. We hope that within whatever budget target is determined, meeting the needs of foster youth in higher education is prioritized by this committee. And finally, these bills include continued funding, albeit at different levels, for paid student teaching grants. Ed Allies strongly believes that student teachers should be paid for their work and has supported investments and policy tweaks in these programs over a number of years. Unfortunately, both bills fall short of dealing with the barrier preventing these dollars from getting in the pockets of student teachers. These grants are treated as financial aid, disqualifying some students of color and students in shortage areas, and decreasing the amount of dollars allocated to qualifying students, which can then be gobbled up first by institutions and fees. The reality is this doesn't end up looking much like a paycheck. Minnesota should stop wrapping these dollars up in the bureaucracy and red tape of financial aid and just pay student teachers directly for their 12 weeks of work in the classroom. The money is there to do it, but the policy isn't right now. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for your public service to our state.
Thank you for your testimony. Any comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll move ahead. Casey Metcalf, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Casey Metcalf. I'm Government Relations Manager for Students United. Today I'm representing Students United and Lead MN, four-year and two-year students in the Minn State system. On behalf Chairs Fate, Rarick, Wolgamott, and members of Higher Education Conference Committee, on behalf of the 120,000 students of our Minn State institutions, thank you for a productive and professional session under rigid budgetary constraints. We're grateful for your efforts to meet directly with students. As you confer, we ask you to consider the following items identified by our students. We are also heartened by the continued funding of Direct Admissions Minnesota, the best-kept secret in Minnesota's education system. The Senate bill authored by Gustafson and Duckworth provides strong statewide implementation and financial support necessary for the Office of Higher Education to funding it at $900,000 a year and requiring all high schools to participate in the program by 2030. The simple requirement, in conjunction with programs like North Star Promise, effectively bridges the gap from K-12 to higher education, cements Minnesota's place as a leader in creating a streamlined process of admission, and to public and private institutions alike, and finally creates a policy solution for Minnesota's lagging FAFSA completion rates. We urge you to place 2030 in statute and create a runway to implementation for this program. Zip code must not determine a student's access to this groundbreaking program with a strong return on investment. We also support the direct transfer of hunger-free campus and emergency grant funds to public colleges and universities rather than requiring a granting process with the Office of Higher Education. Repeatedly, pantry managers across the state have told us that the process for accessing funds is burdensome, sometimes leading to gaps in service like bare shelves or unstaffed pantries. As rates of hunger continue to rise, college students need fully stocked and staffed pantries throughout the school year. Directly appropriating funds to our system reduces bureaucratic red tape and ensures valuable funds make it to students who need it most when they need it most. Third, we're grateful to Senators Fateh, Weber, Kupak, and Abler for championing Narcan access in college dorms, the most likely location for an on-campus overdose. In the past several years, the legislature has made several policy changes and investments in overdose prevention in schools, including mandates for Narcan access in K-12. However, there are no statewide interventions for Minnesota's post-secondary students who are at a much higher risk for overdose than K-12 students. We urge the inclusion of naloxone access in a final omnibus bill, whether health or higher ed, as we continue to collaborate with system partners to modernize policies and procedures around overdose prevention. Finally, in a chaotic federal climate, we ask that you consider provisions that distribute funds equitably. Today, students, especially in MnState, are non-traditional. Programs like Student Parent Support Initiative at OHE are valuable investments in economic mobility. Moreover, if state grant systems lose the ability to recognize negative SAI, we will continue to overlook the needs of the most financially vulnerable students for whom a college education is most transformational. Thank you for your service to the state.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have two students from the University of Minnesota, Shay Horning and Corinna Valinda. If you would come up together, if you're still here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Rarick, Chair Fateh, Chair Wolgamott, and committee members. My name is Shay Horning, and I serve as the Director of State Affairs for the Undergraduate Student Government at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Thank you for your continued leadership and commitment to students. Your work, from creating the North Star Promise Program to supporting basic needs programs, has been life-changing for so many. These policies have not only opened the door to higher education, but signaled that Minnesota believes in its students. But even with this progress, affordability remains the greatest barrier to college enrollment and completion. Recent data shows that 85% of adults who left or never started college cited cost as the primary reason. And among those currently enrolled, more than half of those considering dropping out say it's because they're struggling to pay their monthly bills. Now more than ever, Minnesota must hold the line. Potential federal changes threaten devastating cuts to core programs like Pell Grants for working students, TRIO programs that support first-generation students, and child care grants that student parents rely on to stay enrolled. These cuts will disproportionately harm the most vulnerable among us, and they will land hardest on the very students Minnesota has worked so hard to uplift. That's why we urge you to address the state grant shortfall by adopting the Senate's proposed $90 million increase. We urge you to preserve the recognition of negative student aid index values in the state grant program to ensure that Minnesota's limited financial aid dollars reach the students with the greatest need, advance equity, and reflect the true depth of financial hardship faced by our most vulnerable learners. We also urge you to protect student basic needs by supporting $1.5 million in emergency assistance funding for the University of Minnesota and $2 million for hunger-free campus grants. We urge you to include the College Financing Literacy Act so students can make informed decisions about their debt and sustain programs like the Student Parent Support Initiative, Student Loan Counseling, and Get Ready, which provide essential support beyond tuition. These are not luxuries, these are lifelines. And in the face of looming federal cuts, it is critical that Minnesota continue to lead the way in making higher education accessible, equitable, and sustainable. Thank you for standing with students. With your leadership, we can continue to build a system where every student, not just the most privileged, can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi. Madam Chair and Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karina Valeda, and I'm a Minnesotan who began my journey at Embry Hills Community College and then transferred to University of Minnesota, where I'll graduate next week. On time, in 4 years, my path is not easy. I'm a mom. I've worked many jobs throughout college, internships, fellowships.
I study late at night with my daughter sleeping next to me. And what made this possible was not luck. It was really a financial aid system that saw me, and organizations like the one that received funds from the SPSI, like Raise the Bar Jeremiah program in the University of Minnesota, who helped me pave my way and my success. SPSI is a two-generation solution that allows students like myself to succeed. And by having a system that has labeled me as not having a negative student aid index, that number told the state that this student has an extraordinary financial aid. And because Minnesota recognized that negative number, I have received the support to not just attend college, but to stay, succeed, and finish. And let me be clear, having a negative SAI does not mean that everything was paid for. I still worked. I budgeted every dollar. I moved in with my parents. But all of this helped. It helped me take on more credits, and it helped me focus on my classes, my internships, and my grades instead of just my bills. It helped me graduate with only $10,000 in student loans, and it showed scholarship committees that I was worth the investment. I earned 7 scholarships during my time in college, and that's what happens when we invest in students who need it the most. And I'm not alone. When the state recognizes negative SAI values, it acknowledges the reality that we live in. The federal government allows negative SAIs for a reason. They give a clearer picture of students' financial need. Treating a student with a negative $5,000 SAI as the same as someone with zero SAI hides the critical information and leads to bad policy that creates more inequities in this country. Without recognizing that nuance, we risk overlooking every student who relies on this support. This isn't just about numbers, it's about recognizing human potential, even people who come from low-income communities like myself. It's about trusting students like me who come from families with nothing to spare and give us a chance that we deserve to succeed. When Minnesota recognizes negative SAIs, it tells their students that their struggles do matter and this state does believe in them. It's not just good policy, it's real support, and I urge you to continue that commitment with protecting the negative SAI and the Student Parent Initiative Program, and stand with students like myself to ensure that Minnesota's aid system continues to open doors and not close them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The last one that has signed up, and then I think we have some that are coming after that, Joey Wiley. Do you want a question? Okay, so Chair Fate thought he had a question, but we're going to keep moving forward. So if Joey Wiley would come up. And after that, if there's anyone in the public that has not signed up that wants to testify, you can go ahead and sit in the chairs behind that so I can see how many folks are wanting to testify after him. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hello. Thank you. My name is Joey Wiley, and I will be presenting testimony on behalf of Ariana Shamoon, who is the Interim Executive Director of Foster Advocates. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ariana Shamoon, and I am the Executive Director, Interim Executive Director at Foster Advocates. I'm sorry our team and community of foster leaders were not able to join in person today due to a conflicting community event, but we are here in spirit. Before I go on, I want to lift up the stories I sent over in advance of today's hearing for y'all to see. These past couple of months, we've asked fosters, professionals, and Minnesotans how the Fostering Independence Grants has impacted them. These stories are important and showcase why FIG is needed in our state. I want to remind folks that in order to continue to support the current group of students receiving the grant, we will need nearly $8 million per biennium, which is currently the Senate position. If not increased, the impact will be significant. We anticipate 45% of current students that will be waitlisted this upcoming school year, and 45% is nearly 300 students who the state promised a better future, and 300 students who will lose everything they have worked so hard to overcome. FIG has provided fosters an opportunity for education and an opportunity to create a real stability in their lives. FIG is a true investment. It is the biggest investment that we have as a state, that we as a state have made for fosters and their futures. This is about more than just education, though. FIG is changing lives and breaking generational cycles. I know in this work, it is easy to get caught up in all the failures and the problems with our system because the positives are not always easy to find. But when you find one like FIG, it's critical that we protect it and we see it through to completion. Of all the promises that we have broken as for fosters as a state, this is one we can find a way to keep. And by making FIG whole increasing the base appropriation for future years, we can do just that. because when fosters do better, we all do better. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify and share Interim Director Ariana Shamoon's testimony and for your support of FIG over the years. Let's get this done together. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, moving forward. So we have anyone that has not signed up that would like to testify. If you want to come to the testifier stand, state your record or say your name for the record. You can come up together if you like. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi, thanks so much, Chair Rarick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hugh Gabriel. I'm here with the Bell Museum. Has anyone been to the Bell Museum before? Okay, a couple of you. Awesome. That's great. For those who haven't, I'll give you a quick overview of what we do. We are the state's natural history museum, so we were founded by the Minnesota legislature in 1872. We also have scientific collections. These are housed on the CFANS campus of the University of Minnesota. We have over 1.2 million natural history collections, and we serve the DNR, the DOT, public safety, agriculture, health, and the MPCA here in Minnesota. State funding supports research and science education at the Bell Museum. An example I like to give is our statewide camps up in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. The kids there submitted specimens to our herbarium last summer that have now been added to our over 1 million specimens in that herbarium that will be used for scientific research. We have responsibly stewarded our 280,000 biennium for over 5 decades. That's 42% of our overhead costs. That has not increased recently with inflation. And the cuts proposed by the Senate's higher ed bill will reduce staffing, negatively impacting our ability to deliver on statutory mandates as the state's natural history museum. We anticipate delays with these cuts in service to state agencies, reduction in public access, including to our online Minnesota Biodiversity Atlas, which makes those scientific collections open to the public and organizations like the Minnesota Master Naturalists. With cuts at the federal level to IMLS, it's really tough for us at the museum. We had a $280,000 grant with IMLS that we don't know what's going to happen with it. There's no staff there to administer that grant. And in the last year, we've employed and supported over 40 graduate and undergraduate students, and 10 of those students are completely supported by the state's appropriation. So I wanted to thank the House for including funding for the Bell Museum in their bill, and wanted to encourage all the members of the committee to work on including our funding in the final bill as it goes forward. Thanks so much for your time. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee. We'll take questions after both of them have testified. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Sure. Thank you. Madam Chair, Chair Fata, my name is Jenna Chernega. I'm the president of the Interfaculty Organization, or IFO. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. We recognize the budget constraints that Minnesota faces this biennium and the difficult decisions that the legislature has to make. It's a no-win situation when we have to decide whether to fund healthcare or disability services, education or roads and bridges. That's why the IFO has advocated for raising progressive revenue to protect core state government programs, including higher education. In MinState, we have two sources of revenue, state appropriation and tuition. We're hopeful investments in MinState from the legislature can be included in the final package, but with the unlikelihood of that outcome, we're thankful neither the House or Senate included arbitrary restrictions on tuition for our campuses. MinState campuses have a robust consultation process around tuition that includes students, faculty, staff, and the broader community. When the state doesn't invest, we must turn to tuition to protect the quality of the education we can offer and the student services our students need to succeed. It's time to reprioritize local control for tuition. Even with tuition increases, our campuses will face budget reductions, a reduction in faculty and staff positions, a reduction in program offerings, and more. Indeed, we have already seen this begin at Minnesota State University Mankato with the announcement of one-third of their programs being cut. I look forward to continuing to work with you in future sessions to return our campuses to sustainability. We're thankful the House took measures to rein in the growth of the tuition and fee cap in the state grant program. Given the unchecked growth in the last decade, this variable in the equation has shifted resources exclusively to more costly institutions. The legislature should provide oversight of the tuition and fee cap, as it has previously, to ensure the resources of the program are not prioritized in a way that advantages private institutions over public ones. We're also thankful that the Senate took proactive steps to address our very spooky ghost student problem. This is an issue that arises in online asynchronous programs when bots pretend to be students in order to access financial aid. Although the problem is relatively small right now, the growing capabilities of AI promise to expand this kind of fraud in the future. It's great that in addition to the good work already being done by the MnState system, we're going to do the necessary work to address the problem and ensure that our scarce resources are protected from fraud. Also, our work last session to put guardrails on OPM campuses makes us less susceptible to such fraud in other ways. As always, thank you for the work you do for our students, for our campuses, and for a public higher education system that keeps our state vibrant, competitive, and well-resourced.
Thank you for your testimony. I think there were questions maybe for the Bell Museum. Nope, maybe not. You must have done an amazing job. Thank you so much. Anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify at this point? Seeing none. Yes, you can. So we have the yes, please come back. So Chair Fate has a question for you. Do you want to start your question as she's walking up?
Yeah.
Chair Fate.
And thank you so much, Ms. Valeda, on your testimony, and congratulations on your upcoming graduation. You spoke really well about both the negative SEI, but also the Student Parent Initiative. I guess my question for you is, without the aid from the negative SEI or the support from the Student Parent Initiative, would you have been able to graduate?
I would have gone back to bartending.
Bartending.
So prior to going to school, I bartended at the casino for 9 years, and I love my job. But I just didn't see myself being a bartender with a daughter, working nights, weekends, and holidays, you know, not spending a lot of time with her. So I really, like the supports I got for, through like the Jeremiah program, through Raise the Bar that gave me scholarships, and even summer enrichment funds, really allowed me to spend more time with my daughter, and also focus on school, and focus on internships that, you know, have allowed me, I would say, to write really good scholarship letters, to intern, really just graduate with as little debt as possible. And sometimes I look back at like the people I've known in my life when I was a bartender, and even my coworkers, and how they say, you know, college is so expensive, I still have these debts. And I'm just glad that I'm not in that position. And that's because there's these programs that really have helped me succeed.
Thank you. Senator Fate?
No, thank you so much for giving that. I'm proud of the work we did last biennium, and hoping to continue on that work. We heard a lot about not just the impacts around college affordability, around the student support programs, but the students' abilities to not have to have that job, but pursue internships, and also their ability around graduating, and the positive impacts on their overall academic performance. So thank you for speaking to that, and I appreciate you coming to testify.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fate. Okay, so moving forward, we will be back in this room tomorrow at 3 o'clock. We're going to adopt as many sames and similars as we can. Representative Coulter, do you have a question? Oh, 2 o'clock. Oh, you changed it on me. Okay, I stand corrected. The Senate is saying 2 o'clock. The Senate will have the gavel, so they get to say 2 o'clock tomorrow. Same room. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? So, yeah, we'll be back here at 2 o'clock. We will adopt as many sames and similars as we can. And the last thing I would say is we're not going to be doing any of the budget work until we get an actual target. Thank you all, one and all. We are adjourned. Yes.